Random House Audiobooks presents 3001, The Final Odyssey, by Arthur C. Clarke. Read for you by John Glover.
Called the Firstborn. Though they were not remotely human, they were flesh and blood, and when they looked out across the deeps of space, they had felt awe and wonder and loneliness. As soon as they possessed the power, they began to seek for fellowship among the stars. In their explorations, they encountered life in many forms and watched the workings of evolution on 1,000 worlds. They saw how often the first faint sparks of intelligence flickered and died in the cosmic night. And because in all the galaxy they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers' stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. The great dinosaurs had long since passed away, their morning promise annihilated by a random hammer blow from space, when the survey ship entered the solar system after a voyage that had already lasted 1,000 years. It swept past the frozen outer planets, paused briefly above the deserts of dying Mars, and presently looked down on Earth. Spread out beneath them, the explorers saw a world swarming with life. For years they studied, collected, catalogued. When they had learned all that they could, they began to modify. They tinkered with the deities on land and in the seas. But which of their experiments would bear fruit, they could not know for at least 1,000,000 years. They were patient, but they were not yet immortal. There was so much to do in this universe of 100 billion suns, and other worlds were calling. So they set out once more into the abyss, knowing that they would never come this way again. Nor was there any need. The servants they had left behind would do the rest. On Earth, the glaciers came and went, while above them the changeless moon still carried its secret from the stars. With a yet slower rhythm than the polar ice, the tides of civilization ebbed and flowed across the galaxy. Strange and beautiful and terrible empires rose and fell and passed on their successors. And now, out among the stars, evolution was driving toward new goals. The first explorers of Earth had long since come to the limits of flesh and blood. As soon as their machines were better than their bodies, it was time to move. First their brains, and then their thoughts alone, they transferred into shining new homes of metal and gemstone. In these, they roamed the galaxy. They no longer built spaceships. They were spaceships. But the age of the machine entities swiftly passed. In their ceaseless experimenting, they had learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself, and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. Into pure energy, therefore, they presently transformed themselves, and on 1,000 worlds the empty shells they had discarded twitched for a while in a mindless dance of death, then crumbled into dust. Now they were lords of the galaxy, and could rove at will among the stars, or sink like a subtle mist through the very interstices of space. Though they were freed at last from the tyranny of matter, they had not wholly forgotten their origin in the warm slime of a vanished sea, and their marvelous instruments still continued to function, watching over the experiment started so many ages ago. But no longer were they always obedient to the mandates of their creators. Like all material things, they were not immune to the corruptions of time and its patient, unsleeping servant, entropy. And sometimes they discovered and sought goals of their own. Captain Dimitri Chandler, Mars/Space/Academy, or to his very best friends, was understandably annoyed. The message from Earth had taken 6 hours to reach the space tug Goliath, here beyond the orbit of Neptune. If it had arrived 10 minutes later, he could have answered, "Sorry, can't leave now. We've just started to deploy the sunscreen." The excuse would have been perfectly valid. Wrapping a comet's core in a sheet of reflective film only a few molecules thick, but kilometers on the sun, was not the sort of job you could abandon while it was half completed. Still, it would be a good idea to obey this ridiculous request. He was already in disfavor sunward, through no fault of his own. Collecting ice from the rings of Saturn and nudging it toward Venus and Mercury, where it was really needed, had started back in the 2700s, 3 centuries ago. Captain Chandler had never been able to see any real difference in the before and after images the solar conservers were always producing to support their accusations of celestial vandalism. But the general public, still sensitive to the ecological disasters of previous centuries, had thought otherwise, and the hands-off Saturn vote had passed by a substantial majority. As a result, Chandler was no longer a ring rustler, but a comet cowboy. So, here he was at an appreciable fraction of the distance to Alpha Centauri, rounding up stragglers from the Kuiper Belt. There was certainly enough ice out here to cover Mercury and Venus with oceans kilometers deep, but it might take centuries to extinguish their hellfires and make them suitable for life. The solar conservers, of course, were still protesting against this, though no longer with so much enthusiasm. The million dead from the tsunami caused by the Pacific asteroid in 2304, how ironic that a land impact would have done much less damage, had reminded all future generations that the human race had too many eggs in one fragile basket. Well, Chandler told himself, it would be 50 years before this particular package arrived at its destination, so a delay of a week would hardly make much difference. But all the calculations about rotation, center of mass, and thrust vectors would have to be redone and radioed back to Mars for checking. It was a good idea to do your sums carefully before nudging of ice along an orbit that might take it within hailing distance of Earth. As they had done so many times before, Captain Chandler's eyes strayed toward the ancient photograph above his desk. It showed a 3-masted steamship, dwarfed by the iceberg that was looming above it, as indeed Goliath was dwarfed at this very moment. How incredible, he had often thought, that only one long lifetime spanned the gulf between this primitive discovery and the ship that had carried the same name to Jupiter. And what would those Antarctic explorers of 2,000 years ago have made of the view from his bridge? They would certainly have been disoriented, for the wall of ice beside which Goliath was floating stretched both upward and downward as far as the eye could see. And it was strange-looking ice, wholly lacking the immaculate whites and blues of the frozen polar seas. In fact, it looked dirty, as indeed it was, for only some 90% was water ice. The rest was a witch's brew of carbon and sulfur compounds, most of them stable only at temperatures not far above absolute zero. Thawing them out could produce unpleasant surprises. As one astrochemist had famously remarked, "Comets have bad breath." "Skipper to all personnel," Chandler announced. "There's been a slight change of program. We've been asked to delay operations to investigate a target that Space Guard radar has picked up." "Any details?" somebody asked when the chorus of groans over the ship's intercom had died away. "Not many, but I gather it's another Millennium Committee project they've forgotten to cancel." More groans. Everyone had become heartily sick of all the events planned to celebrate the end of the 2000s. There had been a general sigh of relief when January 1st, 3001, had passed uneventfully and the human race could resume its normal activities. "Anyway, it will probably be another false alarm, like the last one. We'll get back to work just as quickly as we can. Skipper out." This was the third wild goose chase, Chandler thought morosely, he'd been involved with during his career. 5 hours later, the questing Goliath detected the echo at extreme range. Even allowing for the distance, it seemed disappointingly small. However, as it grew clearer and stronger, it began to give the signature of a metallic object perhaps a couple of meters long. It was traveling on an orbit heading out of the solar system, so was almost certainly, Chandler decided, one of the myriad pieces of space junk that mankind had tossed toward the stars during the last millennium, and which might one day provide the only evidence that the human race had ever existed. Then it came close enough for visual inspection, and Captain Chandler realized that some patient historian was still checking the earliest records of the space age. What a pity that the computers had given him the answer just a few years too late for the millennium celebrations. Goliath heard his voice tinged with pride as well as solemnity. "We're bringing aboard a 1,000-year-old astronaut, and I can guess who it is." Frank Poole awoke, but he did not remember. He was not even sure of his name. Obviously, he was in a hospital room, even though his eyes were the most primitive and evocative of his senses told him that. Each breath brought the faint and not unpleasant tang of antiseptics in the air, and it triggered a memory of the time when, of course, as a reckless teenager, he had broken a rib in the Arizona Hang Gliding Championship. Now it was all beginning to come back. "I'm Deputy Commander Frank Poole, Executive Officer, USSS Discovery, on a top-secret mission to Jupiter." It seemed as if an icy hand had gripped his heart. He remembered, in slow-motion playback, that runaway space pod jetting toward him, metal claws outstretched, the silent impact, and the not-so-silent hiss of air rushing out of his suit. After that, one last memory of spinning helplessly in space, trying in vain to reconnect his broken air hose. Well, whatever mysterious accident had happened to the space pod controls, he was safe now. Presumably, Dave had made a quick EVA and rescued him before lack of oxygen could do permanent brain damage. "Good old Dave," he told himself. "I must thank..." Just a moment. "I'm obviously not aboard Discovery now. Surely I haven't been unconscious long enough to be taken back to Earth." The train of thought was abruptly broken by the arrival of a matron and two nurses wearing the immemorial uniform of their profession. They seemed a little surprised. Poole wondered if he had awakened ahead of schedule, and the idea gave him a childish feeling of satisfaction.
"Hello," he said after several attempts. His vocal cords appeared to be very rusty. "How am I doing?"
Matron smiled back at him and gave an obvious "don't try to talk" command by putting a finger to her lips. Then the two nurses fussed swiftly over him with practiced skill, checking pulse, temperature, reflexes. When one of them lifted his right arm and let drop again, Poole noticed something peculiar. It fell slowly, and did not seem to weigh as much as normal. Nor, for that matter, did his body when he attempted to move.
"So I may be on a planet," he thought. "Or a space station with artificial gravity. Certainly not Earth. I don't weigh enough."
He was about to ask the obvious question when Matron pressed something against the side of his neck. A slight tingling sensation, and sank back into a dreamless sleep. Just before he became unconscious, he had time for one more puzzled thought. How odd. They never spoke a single word all the time they were with me. When he woke again and found Matron and nurses standing round his bed, Poole felt strong enough to assert himself.
"Where am I? Surely you can tell me that."
The three women exchanged glances, obviously uncertain what to do next. Then Matron answered, enunciatingly and carefully,
"Everything is fine, Mr. Poole. Professor Anderson will be here in a minute.
He will explain.
Explain what? Thought Poole with some exasperation. But at least she speaks English, even though I can't place her accent.
Anderson must have already been on his way, for the door opened moments later, to give Poole a brief glimpse of a small crowd of inquisitive onlookers peering in at him. He began to feel like a new exhibit at a zoo. Professor Anderson was a small, dapper man whose features seemed to have combined key aspects of several races: Chinese, Polynesian, Nordic, in a thoroughly confusing fashion. He greeted Poole by holding up his right palm, then did an obvious double take and shook hands with such a curious hesitation that he might have been rehearsing some quite unfamiliar gesture.
"Glad to see you're looking so well, Mr. Poole. We'll have you up in no time."
Again that odd accent and slow delivery, but the confident bedside manner was that of all doctors in all places and all ages.
"I'm glad to hear it. Now perhaps you can answer a few questions."
Of course, but just a minute."
Anderson spoke so rapidly and quietly to the matron that Poole could catch only a few words, several of which were wholly unfamiliar to him. Then the matron nodded at one of the nurses, who opened a wall cupboard and produced a slim metal band which she proceeded to wrap around Poole's head.
"What's that for? EEG readout?"
Professor, matron, and nurses looked equally baffled. Then a slow smile spread across Anderson's face.
"Oh, electroencephalogram."
From the depth of memory.
"You're quite right. We just want to monitor your brain functions."
"My brain would function perfectly well if you'd let me use it," Poole grumbled silently. "But at least we seem to be getting somewhere. Finally."
"Mr. Poole,"
said Anderson, still speaking in that curiously stilted voice, as if venturing in a foreign language,
"you know, of course, that you were disabled in a serious accident while you were working outside Discovery."
Poole nodded agreement.
"I'm beginning to suspect that disabled is a slight understatement."
Anderson relaxed visibly, and a slow smile spread across his face.
"You're quite correct. Tell me what you think happened."
"Well, the best case scenario is that after I became unconscious, Dave Bowman rescued me and brought me back to the ship. How is Dave? No one will tell me anything."
"All in due course, and the worst case."
It seemed to Frank Poole that a chill wind was blowing gently on the back of his neck. The suspicion that had slowly been forming in his mind began to solidify. "That I died, but was brought back here, wherever here is, and you've been able to revive me. Thank you."
"Quite correct. And you're back on Earth.
Well, very near it."
What did he mean by "very near it"? There was certainly a gravity field here, so he was probably inside the slowly turning wheel of an orbit. No matter, there was something much more important to think about. Poole did some quick mental calculations. If Dave had put him in the hibernaculum, revived the rest of the crew, and completed the mission to Jupiter, why, he could have been dead for as much as 5 years. "Just what date is it?" he asked, as calmly as possible. Professor and matron exchanged glances. Again Poole felt that cold wind on his neck.
"I must tell you, Mr. Poole, that Bowman did not rescue you. He believed, and we cannot blame him, that you were irrevocably dead. Also, he was facing a desperately serious crisis that threatened his own survival. So you drifted on into space
passed through the Jupiter system and headed out toward the stars. Fortunately, you were so far below freezing point that there was no metabolism, but it's a near miracle that you were ever found at all. You are one of the luckiest men alive. No, ever to have lived.
Am I? Poole asked himself bleakly. 5 years, indeed. It could be a century, or even more.
Let me have it, he demanded. Professor and matron seemed to be consulting an invisible monitor. When they looked at each other and nodded agreement, Poole guessed that they were all plugged into the hospital information circuit, linked to the headband he was wearing.
Frank, said Professor Anderson, making a smooth switch to the role of longtime family physician, this will be a great shock to you, but dang it, and the sooner you know, the better. We are near the beginning of the fourth millennium. Believe me, you left Earth almost 1,000 years ago.
I believe you, Poole answered calmly. Then, to his great annoyance, the room started to spin around him, and he knew nothing more. When he regained consciousness, he found that he was no longer in a bleak hospital room, but in a luxurious suite with attractive and steadily changing images on the walls. Some of these were famous and familiar paintings. Others showed land and seascapes that might have been from his own time. There was nothing alien or upsetting. That, he guessed, would come later. His present surrounding had obviously been carefully programmed. He wondered if there was the equivalent of a television screen somewhere. How many channels would the third millennium have? But could see no sign of any controls near his bed. There was so much he would have to learn in this new world. He was a savage who had suddenly encountered civilization. But first he must regain his strength and learn the language. Not even the advent of sound recording, already more than a century old when Poole was born, had prevented major changes in grammar and pronunciation. And there were thousands of new words, mostly from science and technology, though often he was able to make a shrewd guess at their meaning. More frustrating, however, were famous and infamous personal names that had accumulated over the millennium, and which meant nothing to him. For weeks, until he had built a data bank, most of his conversations had to be interrupted with potted biographies. As Poole's strength increased, so did the number of his visitors, though always under Professor Anderson's watchful eye. They included medical specialists, scholars of several disciplines, and, of the greatest interest to him, spacecraft commanders. There was little that he could tell the doctors and historians that was not recorded somewhere in mankind's gigantic database, but he was often able to give them shortcuts and new insights about the events of his own time. Though they all treated him with the utmost respect and listened patiently as he tried to answer their questions, they seemed reluctant to answer his. Poole began to feel that he was being overprotected from culture shock, and half-seriously wondered how he could escape from his suite. On the few occasions he was alone, he was not surprised to discover that the door was locked. Then the arrival of Dr. Indra Wallace changed everything. Despite her name, her chief racial component appeared to be Japanese, and there were times when, with just a little imagination, Poole could picture her as a rather mature geisha girl. It was hardly an appropriate image for a distinguished historian, holding a virtual chair at a university still boasting real ivy. She was the first visitor with a fluent command of Poole's own English, so he was delighted to meet her.
Mr. Poole, she began in a very businesslike voice, I've been appointed your official guide and, let's say, mentor. My qualifications, I've specialized, period. My thesis was the collapse of the nation-state, 2000 to 2050. I believe we can help each other in many ways. I'm sure we can. First, I'd like you to get me out of here so I can see a little of your world.
Exactly what we intend to do. But first, we must give you an ident. Until then, you'll be... what was the term? A non-person. It would be almost impossible for you to go anywhere or get anything done. No input device would recognize your existence.
Just what I expected, Poole answered it with a wry smile. It was starting to get that way in my own time, and many people hated the idea.
Some still do. They go off and live in the wilderness. There's a lot more on Earth than there was in your century, but they always take their compacts with them, so they can call for help as soon as they get into trouble. The median time is about 5 days.
Sorry to hear that. The human race has obviously deteriorated. He was cautiously testing her, trying to find the limits of her tolerance and to map out her personality. It was obvious they were going to spend much time together, and that he would have to depend on her in hundreds of ways. Yet he was still not sure if he would even like her. Perhaps she regarded him merely as a fascinating museum exhibit. Rather, to Poole's surprise, she agreed with his criticism.
That may be true in some respects. Perhaps we're physically weaker, but we're healthier and better adjusted than most humans who have ever lived. The noble savage was always a myth.
She walked over to a small rectangular plate set at eye level in the door. It was about the size of one of the countless magazines that had proliferated in the far-off age of print, and Poole had noticed that every room seemed to have at least one. Usually they were blank, but sometimes they contained lines of text, completely meaningless to Poole, even when most of the words were familiar. Dr. Wallace laid the palm of her hand upon the plate, then removed it after a few seconds. She glanced at Poole and said smilingly, "Come and look at this." The inscription that had suddenly appeared made a good deal of sense when he read it slowly. Wallace, comma, Indra, bracket, F2970.031.885/hist.oxford. I suppose it means female, date of birth, March 11th, 2970, and that you're associated with the Department of History at Oxford. And I guess that 31.885 is a personal identification number, correct?
Excellent, Mr. Poole. I've seen some of your email addresses and credit card numbers, hideous strings of alphanumeric gibberish that no one could possibly remember. But we all know our date of birth, and not more than 99,999 other people will share it. So a five-figure number is all you'll ever need. And even if you forget that, it doesn't really matter. As you see, it's a part of you.
Implant?
Yes. Nanochip at birth. 1-inch palm for redundancy. You won't even feel your goes in. But you've given us a small problem.
What's that?
The readers you'll meet most of the time are too simple-minded to believe your date of birth. So, with your permission, we've moved it up 1,000 years.
Permission granted. And the rest of the ident?
Optional. You can leave it empty, give your current interests and location, or use it for personal messages, global or targeted.
Some things, Poole was quite sure, would not have changed over the centuries. A high proportion of those targeted messages would be very personal indeed. He wondered if there were still self- or state-appointed censors in this day and age, and if their efforts at improving other people's more successful than in his own time. He would have to ask Dr. Wallace about that, when he got to know her better.
Frank, Professor Anderson thinks you're strong enough to go for a little walk.
I'm very pleased to hear it. Do you know the expression, stir crazy?
No, but I can guess what it means.
Poole had so adapted to the low gravity that the long strides he was taking seemed perfectly normal. Half a G, he had estimated, just right to give the sense of well-being. Poole and Dr. Wallace met only a few people on their walk, all of them strangers, but every one of them gave a smile of recognition. By now, Poole told himself with a trace of smugness, I must be one of the best-known celebrities in this world. That should be a great help when I decide what to do with the rest of my life. At least another century, if I can believe Anderson. The corridor along which they were walking was completely featureless, apart from occasional numbered doors, each bearing one of the universal recog panels. Poole had followed Indra for perhaps 200 meters when he came to a sudden halt, shocked because he had not realized something so blindingly obvious. This space station must be enormous. Indra smiled back at him.
Didn't you have a saying, you ain't seen anything yet?
Nothing, he corrected absent-mindedly. He was still trying to estimate the scale of the structure when he had another surprise. Who would have imagined a space station large enough to boast a subway? Admittedly, a miniature one, with a single small coach capable of seating only a dozen passengers.
Observation Lounge 3, ordered Indra, and they drew silently and swiftly away from the terminal.
Poole checked the time on the elaborate wristband whose functions he was still exploring. As far as Poole could judge by speed and elapsed time, they must have traveled at least 3 kilometers before the vehicle came to a silent stop. The doors opened, and a bland auto-voice intoned,
Have a good view. 30% cloud cover today.
At last, Poole thought, we're getting near the outer wall. But here was another mystery. Despite the distance he had gone, neither the strength nor the direction of gravity had altered. He could not imagine a spinning space station so huge that the G-vector would not be changed by such a displacement. Could he really be on some planet after all? But he would feel lighter, usually much lighter, on any other habitable world in the solar system. When the outer door of the terminal opened and Poole found himself entering a small airlock, he realized that he must indeed be in space. But where were the space suits? He looked around anxiously. It was against all his instincts to be so close to vacuum, naked and unprotected. One experience of that was enough.
We're nearly there, said Indra reassuringly.
The last door opened, and he was looking out into the utter blackness of space, through a huge window that was curved both vertically and horizontally. He felt like a goldfish in its bowl, and hoped that the designers of this audacious piece of engineering knew exactly what they were doing. They certainly possessed better structural materials than had existed. Though the stars must be shining out there, his light-adapted eyes could see nothing but black emptiness beyond the curve of the great window. As he started to walk toward it to get a wider view, Indra restrained him and pointed straight ahead.
Look carefully. Don't you see it?
Poole blinked and stared into the night. Surely it must be an illusion. Even, heaven forbid, a crack in the window. He moved his head from side to side. No, it was real. But what could it be? He remembered Euclid's definition. A line has length, but no thickness. For spanning the whole height of the window and obviously continuing out of sight above and below was a thread of light quite easy to see when he looked for it, yet so one-dimensional that the word thin could not even be applied. However, it was not completely featureless. There were barely visible spots of greater brilliance at irregular intervals along its length, like drops of water on a spider's web.
Poole continued walking toward the window, and the view expanded until at last he could see what lay below him. It was familiar enough. The whole continent of Europe and much of northern Africa, just as he had seen them many times from space. So he was in orbit, after all, probably an equatorial one, at a rate of at least 1,000 kilometers. Indra looked at him with a quizzical smile. "Go closer to the window, so that you can look straight down. I hope you have a good head for heights." What a silly thing to say to an astronaut, Poole told himself as he moved forward. If I ever suffered from vertigo, I wouldn't be in this business. The thought had barely passed through his mind when he cried, "My God!" and involuntarily stepped back from the window. Then, bracing himself, he dared to look again. He was looking down on the distant Mediterranean from the face of a cylindrical tower whose gently curving wall indicated a diameter of several kilometers. But that was nothing compared with its length, for it tapered away down, 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 until it disappeared into the mists somewhere over Africa. He assumed that it continued all the way to the surface.
"How high are we?" he whispered.
2,000 K. But now, look upward." This time it was not such a shock. He had expected what he would see. The tower dwindled away until it became a glittering thread against the blackness of space, and he did not doubt that it continued all the way to the geostationary orbit, 36,000 kilometers above the equator. Such fantasies had been well known in Poole's day. He had never dreamed he would see the reality, and be living in it. He pointed toward the distant thread reaching up from the eastern horizon.
"That must be another one."
"Yes, the Asian Tower. We must look exactly the same to them."
"How many are there?"
"Just 4, equally spaced around the equator. Africa, Asia, America, Pacifica. The last one's almost empty, only a few 100 levels completed. Nothing to see except water."
Poole was still absorbing this stupendous concept when a disturbing thought occurred to him. There were already thousands of satellites at all sorts of altitudes in my time. How do you avoid collisions?
Indra looked slightly embarrassed. "You know, I never thought about that. It's not my field." She paused for a moment, clearly searching her memory. Then her face brightened.
"I believe there was a big clean-up operation centuries ago. There just aren't any satellites below the stationary orbit."
That made sense, Poole told himself. They wouldn't be needed. The 4 gigantic towers could provide all the facilities once provided by thousands of satellites and space stations.
"And there've never been any accidents, any collisions with spaceships leaving Earth or re-entering the atmosphere?"
Indra looked at him with surprise.
"But they don't anymore." She pointed to the ceiling. "All the spaceports are where they should be, up there on the outer ring. I believe it's 400 years since the last rocket lifted off from the surface of the Earth."
Poole was still digesting this when a trivial anomaly caught his attention. His training as an astronaut had made him alert to anything out of the ordinary. Space that might be a matter of life or death. The sun was out of view, high overhead, but its rays streaming down through the great window painted a brilliant band of light on the floor underfoot. Cutting across that band at an angle was another, much fainter one, so that the frame of the window shadow. Poole had to go almost down on his knees so that he could peer up at the sky. He had thought himself beyond surprise, but the spectacle of 2 suns left him momentarily speechless.
"What's that?" he gasped when he had recovered his breath.
"Oh, haven't you been told? That's Lucifer."
"Earth has another sun?"
"Well, it doesn't give us much heat, but it's put the moon out of business.
Before the second mission went there to look for you, that was the planet Jupiter."
I knew I would have much to learn in this new world, Poole told himself. But just how much, I never dreamed. Poole was both astonished and delighted when the television set was wheeled into the room and positioned at the end of his bed. Delighted because he was suffering from mild information starvation, and astonished because it was a model which had been obsolete even in his own time. "We've had to promise the museum we'll give it back," Matron informed him. "And I expect you know how to use this." As he fondled the remote controller, Poole felt a wave of nostalgia sweep over him. As few other artifacts could, it brought back memories of his childhood and the days when most television sets were too stupid to understand spoken commands. "You, Matron, what's the best news?" She seemed puzzled by his question, then brightened. "Oh, I see what you mean. But Professor Ann thinks you're not quite ready yet. So Oz has put together a collection that will make you feel at home." Poole wondered briefly what the storage medium was in this day and age. He could still remember compact discs, and his eccentric old Uncle George had been the proud possessor of a vintage LP collection, but the technological contest was centuries ago, in the usual Darwinian way, with the survival of the fittest. He had to admit the selection was well done, by someone, Indra, familiar with the early 20th century. There was nothing disturbing, no wars or violence, and very temporary business or politics, all of which would now be utterly irrelevant. There were some light comedies, sporting events. How did they know that he had been a keen tennis fan? Classical and pop music, and wildlife documentaries. And whoever had put this collection together must have had a sense of humor, or they would not have included episodes from each Star Trek series. As a very small boy, Poole had met both Patrick Stewart and Leonard Nimoy. He wondered what they would have thought, could they have known that he had shyly asked for their autographs. A depressing thought occurred to him, soon after he had started exploring, much of the time in Fast Forward, these relics of the past. He had read somewhere that by the turn of the century, his century, there were approximately 50,000 television stations broadcasting simultaneously. If that figure had been maintained, and it might well have increased, by now millions and millions of hours of TV programming must have gone on the air. So even the most hardened cynic would admit that there were probably at least a billion hours of worthwhile viewing, and millions that would pass the highest standards of excellence. How to find these few needles in so gigantic a haystack? The thought was so overwhelming, indeed so demoralizing, that after a week of increasingly aimless channel surfing, Poole asked for the set to be removed. Perhaps, fortunately, he had less and less time to bring his waking hours, which were steadily growing longer as his strength came back. There was no risk of boredom, thanks to the continual parade not only of serious researchers, but also inquisitive and presumably influential citizens who had managed to filter past the palace guard established by Matron and Professor Anderson. Nevertheless, he was glad when, one day, the television set reappeared. He was beginning to suffer from withdrawal symptoms, and this time he resolved to be more selective in his viewing. The venerable antique was accompanied by Indra Wallace, smiling broadly. "We've found something you must see, Frank. We think it will help adjust. Anyway, we're sure you'll enjoy it." Poole had always found that remark a recipe for guaranteed boredom, and prepared for the worst. But the opening had him instantly hooked, taking him back to his old life as few other things could have done. At once he recognized one of the most famous voices of his age, and remembered that he had seen this very program before. "Atlanta, December 31st, 2000. This is CNN International, 5 minutes from the dawn of a new millennium, with all its unknown perils and promise. Before we try to explore the world, let's look back 1,000 years and ask ourselves, could any persons living in 1000 A.D. even remotely imagine our world, or understand it, if they were magically transported across the centuries?
Almost the whole of the technology we take for granted was invented near the very end of your millennium, most of it in the last 200 years. The steam, electricity, telephones, radio, television, cinema, aviation, electronics, and during a single lifetime, nuclear energy and space travel. What would the minds of the past made of these? How long could an Archimedes or a Leonardo have retained his sanity if suddenly dumped into our world? It's tempting to think that we could do better if we were transported 1,000 years hence. Surely the fundamental scientific discoveries have already been made. Though there will be major improvements in technology, will there be any devices, anything as magical and incomprehensible to us as a pocket calculator or a video camera would have been to Isaac Newton? Perhaps our age is indeed sundered from all those that have gone before. Telecommunications. The ability to record images and sounds once irrevocably lost. The conquest of the air and space. All these have created a civilization beyond the wildest fantasies of the past. And equally important, Copernicus, Newton, Darwin, and Einstein have so changed our mode of thinking and our outlook on the universe that we might seem almost a new species to the most brilliant of our predecessors. And will our successors, 1,000 years from now, look back on us with the same pity with which we regard our ignorant, superstitious, disease-ridden, short-lived ancestors? We believe that we know the answers to questions that they could not even ask, but what's price the third millennium for us? Well, hymns! A great bell began to toll the strokes of midnight. The last vibration throbbed into silence. And that's the way it was. Goodbye, wonderful and terrible 20th century. Then the picture broke into a myriad of fragments, and a new commentator took over, speaking with the accent which Poole may understand, and which immediately brought him up to the present. Now, in the first minute's thousand, we can answer that question from the past. Certainly the people of 2001, who you were just watching, would not feel as utterly overwhelmed in our age as someone from 2001 would have been in theirs. Many technological achievements they would have anticipated. Indeed, they would have expected satellite cities and colonies on the moon and planets. They might even have been disappointed because we are not yet immortal and have sent probes only to the nearest stars. Abruptly, Indra switched off the recording. See the rest later, Frank. You're getting tired. But I hope it will help you to adjust. Thank you, Indra. I'll have to sleep on it. But it certainly proved one point. What's that? I should be grateful I'm not 1001 or dropped into 2001. That would be too much of a quantum leap. I don't believe anyone could adjust to it. At least I know about electricity and won't die of fright if a picture starts talking at me. I hope, Poole told himself, that confidence is justified. Someone once said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Will I meet magic in this new world and be able to handle it?
I'm afraid you'll have to make an agonizing decision, said Professor Anderson, with a smile that neutralized the exaggerated gravity of his words.
I can take it, Doctor. Just give it to me straight.
Before you can be fitted with your brain cap, you have to be completely bald. So, here's your choice. At the rate your hair grows, you'd have to be shaved at least once a month, or you could have a permanent.
How's that done?
Laser scalp treatment. Kills the follicles at roots.
Is it reversible?
Yes, but that's messy and painful, and takes weeks.
Then I'll see how I like being hairless before committing myself. Still, I wouldn't mind losing my beard. I'd be happy to stop shaving once and for all.
I'll make the arrangements. And what kind of wig would you like?
Poole laughed. I'm not particularly vain. I think it would be a nuisance and probably won't bother. Something else I can decide later. That everyone in this era was artificially bald was a surprising fact that Poole had been quite slow to discover. His first revelation had come when both his nurses removed their luxuriant tresses, without the slightest sign of embarrassment, just before several equally bald specialists arrived to give him a series of microbiological checks. Professor Anderson wasted no time. That afternoon, the nurses smeared some evil-smelling cream over Poole's head, and when he looked into the mirror an hour later, he did not recognize himself. Well, he thought, perhaps a wig would be a good idea, after all. The brain cap fitting took somewhat longer. First, a mold had to be made, which required him to sit motionless for a few minutes until the plaster set. Next came the skull cap itself, a metal helmet that fitted snugly almost down to the ears. After a few minutes, it was visible that he was unaware of its presence. Now he was ready for the installation, a process which he now realized with something akin to awe had been the rite of passage for almost all the human race for more than half a millennium.
"There's no need to close your eyes," said the technician, who had used by the pretentious title of brain engineer, almost always shortened to brain man in popular usage. "When setup begins, all your inputs will be taken over. Even if your eyes are open, you won't see anything."
"I wonder if everyone feels as nervous as this," Poole asked himself. "Is this the last moment I'll be in control of my own mind? Still, I've learned to trust the technology of this age. Up to now, it hasn't let me down. Of course, as the old saying goes, there's always a first time." As he had been promised, he had felt nothing except a gentle tickling as the myriads of nanowires wormed their way through his scalp. All his senses were still perfectly normal when he scanned his familiar room. Everything was exactly where it should be. The brain man, wearing his own skull cap, wired, like Poole's, to a piece of equipment that could easily have been mistaken for a 20th-century laptop computer, gave him a reassuring smile.
"Ready?"
There were times when the old clichés were the best ones. "Ready as I'll ever be," Poole answered. Slowly, the light faded, or seemed to. A great silence descended, and even the gentle gravity of the tower relinquished its hold upon him. He was an embryo, floating in a featureless void, though not in complete darkness. From a great distance, a voice spoke out of the immense void that now seemed to surround him. But it did not reach him through his ears. It sounded softly in the echoing labyrinths of his brain.
"Calibration starting. From time to time, you will ask questions, answer mentally, but it may help to vocalize. Do you understand?"
"Yes," Poole replied, wondering if his lips were indeed moving. There was no way that he could tell. Something was appearing in the void, a grid of thin lines, like a huge sheet of graph paper. It extended up and down, right and left, to the limits of his vision. He tried to move his head, but the image refused to change. Numbers started to flicker across the grid, too fast for him to read, but presumably some circuit was recording them. Poole could not help smiling. Did his cheeks move? At the familiarity of it all. This was just like the computer-driven eye examination that any oculist of his age would give a client. Poole muttered silently, "My vision's perfect. Next for hearing, I suppose." He was quite correct. That was the last of the simple, straightforward tests. He was briefly assailed by scents and flavors, most of them pleasant, but some quite the reverse. Then he became, or so it seemed, a puppet on an invisible string. He presumed that his neuromuscular control was being tested, and for one moment he even had a violent erection, but was unable to give it a reality check before he fell into a dreamless sleep.
Or did he only dream that he slept? He had no idea how much time had elapsed before he awoke. The helmet had already gone, together with the brain man and his equipment.
"Everything went fine," beamed Matron. "It will take a few hours to check that there are no anomalies. If your readings KO, I mean, okay, you'll have your brain cap tomorrow."
Poole appreciated the efforts of his entourage to learn archaic English, but he could not help wishing that Matron had not made that unfortunate slip of the tongue. When the time came for the final fitting, Poole felt almost like a boy again, about to unwrap some wonderful new toy under the...
"You won't have to go through all that setting up again," the brain man assured him. "Download will start immediately. I'll give you a 5-minute demo. Just relax and enjoy."
Gentle, soothing music washed over him. Though it was something very familiar from his own time, he could not identify it. There was a mist before his eyes, which parted as he walked toward it. Yes, he was walking. The illusion was utterly convincing. He could feel the impact of his feet on the ground, and now that the music had stopped, he could hear a gentle wind blowing through the great trees that appeared to surround him. He recognized them as California redwoods, and hoped that they still existed in reality, somewhere on Earth. He was moving at a brisk pace, too fast for comfort, as if time was slightly accelerated so he could cover as much ground as possible. Yet he was not conscious of any effort. He felt he was a guest in someone else's body. The sensation was enhanced by the fact that he had no control over his movements. When he attempted to stop or to change direction, nothing happened. He was going along for the ride. It did not matter. He was enjoying the novel experience, and could appreciate how addictive it could become. The dream machines that many scientists of his own century had anticipated, often with alarm, were now part of everyday life. Poole wondered how mankind had managed to survive. He had been told that much of it had not. Millions had been brain-burned and had dropped out of life. Of course, he would be immune to such temptation. He would use this marvelous tool to learn more about the world of the third millennium, and to acquire in minutes new skills that would otherwise take years to master. Well, he might just occasionally use the brain cap purely for fun. He had come to the edge of the forest and was looking out across a wide river. Without hesitation, he walked into it and felt no alarm as the water rose over his head. It did seem strange that he could continue breathing naturally, but he thought it much more remarkable that he could see perfectly in a medium where the unaided human eye could not focus. He could count every scale on the magnificent trout that went swimming past. The river ended in a translucent wall. He stepped through it, onto the face of a desert beneath a blazing sun. Its heat burned him uncomfortably, yet he was able to look directly into its noonday fury. Everything faded to black. The haunting music returned, and with it the blissful coolness of his familiar room. He opened his eyes, had they ever been closed, and found an expectant audience waiting for his reaction. "Wonderful," he breathed, almost reverently. Some of it seemed, well, realer than real. Then his engineer's curiosity, never far from the surface, started nagging. Even that short demo must have contained an enormous amount of information. How's it stored?
In these tablets. The same your audiovisual system uses, but with much greater capacity.
The brain man handed Poole a small square, apparently made of glass,
silvered on one surface. It was almost the same size as the computer diskettes of his youth, but twice the thickness. As Poole tilted it back and forth, trying to see into its transparent interior, there were occasional rainbow-hued flashes, but that was all. He was holding, he realized, the end product of more than 1,000 years of electro-optical technology, as well as other technologies unborn in his era. And it was not surprising that, superficially, it closely resembled the devices he had known. There was a convenient shape and size for most of the common objects of everyday life. Knives and forks, books, hand tools, furniture, and removable memories for computers. In my time, we were up to a terabyte in something this size. I'm sure you've done a lot better.
Not as much as you might imagine. There's a limit, of course, set by the structure of matter. By the way, what was a terabyte? Afraid I've forgotten.
Shame on you. That's kilo, mega, giga, tera. That's 10^12 bytes. Then the petabyte. 10^15. That's as far as I ever got.
That's about where we start. It's enough to record everything any person can experience during one lifetime.
It was an astonishing thought, yet it should not have been so surprising. The kilogram of jelly inside the human skull was not much larger than the tablet Poole was holding in his hand, and it could not possibly be as efficient a storage device. It had so many other duties to deal with.
And that's not all, the brain man continued. With some data compression, it could store not only the memories, but the actual person.
And reproduce them again?
Of course. Straightforward job of nano-assembly.
So I'd heard, Poole told himself, but I'd never really believed it. Back in his century, it seemed wonderful enough that the entire life work of a great artist could be stored on a single small disk. And now, something no larger could hold the artist as well.
I'm delighted, said Poole, to know that the Smithsonian still exists after all these centuries.
You probably wouldn't recognize it, said a visitor who had introduced himself as Dr. Alistair Kim, director of astronautics, especially as it's now scattered over the solar system. The main off-Earth collections are on Mars and the Moon, and many of the exhibits that legally belong to us are still heading for the stars. Someday we'll catch up with them, bring them home. We're particularly anxious to get our hands on 10, the first man-made object to escape from the solar system.
I believe I was on the verge of doing that when they located me.
Lucky for you, and for us, you may be able to throw light on many things we don't know.
Frankly, I doubt it, but I'll do my best. I don't remember a thing after that runaway space pod charged me, though I still find it hard to believe. I've been told that Hal was responsible.
That's true, but it's a complicated story. Everything we've been able to learn is in this recording, about 20 hours, but you can probably fast most of it. You know, of course, that Dave Bowman went out in the No. 2 pod to rescue you, but was then locked outside the ship because Hal refused to open the pod bay doors.
Why, for God's sake?
Dr. Kim winced slightly. It was not the first time Poole had noticed such a reaction. Must watch my language, he thought. God seems to be a dirty word in this culture. Must ask Indra about it.
There was a major programming error in Hal's instructions. He'd been given control of aspects of the mission you and Bowman didn't know about. It's all in the recording. Anyway, he also cut off the life support systems to 3 hibernauts, the Alpha crew, and Bowman had to jettison their bodies as well.
So Dave and I were the Beta crew, something else I didn't know.
What happened to them? Poole asked. Couldn't they have been rescued just as I was?
I'm afraid not. We've looked at it.
Bowman ejected them several hours after he'd taken back control from Hal, so their orbits were slightly different from yours,
just enough for them to burn up in Jupiter, while you skimmed by and got a gravity boost that would have taken you to the Orion Nebula in a few thousand more years. Doing everything on manual override, really a fantastic performance, Bowman managed to get Discovery into orbit round Jupiter, and there he encountered what the second expedition called Big Brother, an apparent twin of the Tycho monolith, but hundreds of times larger. And that's where we lost him. He left Discovery in the remaining space pod and made a rendezvous with Big Brother. For almost 1,000 years, we've been haunted by his last message. By Deus, it's full of stars.
Here we go again, Poole told himself. No way Dave could have said that. Must have been, my God, it's full of stars.
Apparently, the pod was drawn into the monolith by some kind of inertial field because it, and presumably Bowman, survived an acceleration which should have crushed them instantly. And that was the last information anyone had for almost 10 years until the joint U.S.-Russian Leonov mission,
which made a rendezvous with the abandoned Discovery so that Dr. Chandra could go aboard and reactivate Hal. Yes, I know that. Dr. Kim looked slightly embarrassed.
Sorry, I wasn't sure how much you'd been told already. Anyway, that's when even stranger things started to happen. Apparently, the arrival of Leonov triggered something inside Big Brother. If we did not have these recordings, no one would have believed what happened. Let me show you. Here's Dr. Heywood Floyd keeping the midnight watch aboard Discovery after power had been restored. Of course, you'll recognize everything.
Indeed I do. And how strange to see the long-haired Heywood Floyd sitting in my old seat with Hal's unblinking red eyes surveying everything in sight. And even stranger to think that Hal and I have both shared the same experience of resurrection from the dead. A message was coming up on one of the monitors, and Floyd answered lazily. Okay, Hal, who is calling?
No identification.
Floyd looked slightly annoyed. Very well. Please give me the message.
It is dangerous to remain here. You must leave within 15 days.
That is absolutely impossible. Our launch window does not open until 26 days from now. We do not have sufficient propellant for an earlier departure.
I am aware of these facts. Nevertheless, you must leave within 15 days.
I cannot take this warning seriously unless I know its origin. Who is speaking to me?
I was David Bowman. It is important that you believe me. Look behind you.
Heywood Floyd slowly turned in his swivel chair, away from the banked panels and switches of the computer display, toward the Velcro-covered catwalk behind. Watch this carefully, said Dr. Kim. The zero-gravity environment of Discovery's observation deck was much dustier than he remembered it. He guessed that the air filtration plant had not yet been brought online. The parallel rays of the distant yet brilliant sun, streaming through the great windows, lit up myriads of dancing motes in a classic display of Brownian movement. And now something strange was happening to these particles of dust. Some force seemed to be marshaling them, herding them away from a central point, yet bringing others toward it until they all met on the surface of a hollow sphere. That sphere, about a meter across, hovered in the air for a moment like a giant soap bubble. Then it elongated into an ellipsoid whose surface began to pucker, to form folds and indentations. Poole was surprised when it started to assume the shape of a man. He had seen such figures blown out of glass in museums and science exhibitions. But this dusty phantom did not even approximate anatomical accuracy. It was like a crude clay figurine, or one of the primitive works of art found in the recesses of Stone Age caves. Only the head was fashioned with care, and the face, beyond all shadow of doubt, was that of Commander David Bowman.
Hello, Dr. Floyd. Now do you believe me?
The lips of the figure never moved. Poole realized that the voice, yes, certainly Bowman's voice, was actually coming from the speaker grill. This is very difficult for me, and I have little time. I have been allowed to give this warning. You have only 15 days.
Why? And what are you?
But the ghostly figure was already fading,
its grainy envelope beginning to dissolve back into the constituent particles of dust. "Goodbye, Dr. Floyd. We can have no further contact, but there may be one more message if all goes well." As the image dissolved, Poole could not help smiling at that old space-age cliché, "If all goes well." How many times he had heard that phrase intoned before a mission. The phantom vanished. Only the motes of dancing dust were left, resuming their random patterns in the air. With an effort of will, Poole came back to the present.
"Well, Commander, what do you think of that?" asked Kim.
Poole was still shaken, and it was several seconds before he could reply. The face and the voice were Bowman's, I'd swear to that. But what was it?
"That's what we're still arguing about. Call it a hologram, a projection. Of course there are plenty of ways it could be faked if anyone wanted to, but not in these circumstances. And then, of course, there's what happened next."
"Lucifer."
"Yes. Thanks to that warning, they had just sufficient time to get away before Jupiter detonated.
So, whatever it was, the Bowman thing was friendly and trying to help, presumably.
And that's not the last time it appeared. It may have been responsible for that one more message warning us not to attempt any landing on Europa.
And we never have.
Only once, by accident, when Galaxy was hijacked and forced down there 36 years later, and her sister ship, Universe, had to go to the rescue. It's all here with what little our robot monitors have told us about the Europans.
I'm anxious to see them.
They're amphibious and come in all shapes and sizes. As soon as Lucifer started melting the ice that covered their whole world, they began to emerge from the sea. Since then, they've developed at a speed that seems biologically impossible.
From what I remember about Europa, weren't there lots of cracks in the ice? Perhaps they'd already started crawling through and having a look around.
That's a widely accepted theory, but here's another, much more speculative one. The monolith may have been involved in ways we don't yet understand. What triggered that line of thought was the discovery of TMA-0. Right here on Earth, almost 500 years after your time. I suppose you've been told about that.
Only vaguely. There's been so much to catch up with. I did think the name was ridiculous, since it wasn't a magnetic anomaly, and it was in Africa, not Tycho.
You're quite right, of course, but we're studying. And the more we learn about the monoliths, the more the puzzle deepens, especially as they're still the only real evidence for advanced technology beyond the Earth.
That surprised me. I should have thought that by this time we'd have picked up radio signals from somewhere. The astronomers started searching when I was a boy.
Well, there is one hint, and it's so terrifying that we don't like to talk about it. Have you heard of Nova Scorpio?
I don't believe so.
Stars go nova all the time, of course, and this wasn't a particularly impressive one. But before it blew up, N-Scorp was known to have several planets.
Inhabited?
Absolutely no way of telling. Radio searchers have picked up nothing. And here's the nightmare. Luckily, the automatic Nova Patrol caught the event at the very beginning. And it didn't start at the star. One of the planets detonated first, and then triggered its sun.
My God!
Sorry. Go on. You see the point. It's impossible for a planet to go nova, except in one. I once read a sick joke in a science fiction novel. Supernovae are industrial accidents. It wasn't a supernova, but it seems that it's no joke. The most widely accepted theory is that someone else had been tapping vacuum energy and had lost control.
War.
Just as bad, we'll probably never know. But as our own civilization depends on the same energy source, you understand why N-Scorp sometimes gives us nightmares. Having nuclear reactors to worry about.
Not any longer, thank Deus.
But I really wanted to tell you more about TMA-0's discovery, because it marked a turning point in human history. Finding TMA-1
On the moon was a big enough shock, but 500 years later there was a worse one, and it was much nearer home, in every sense of the word, down there in Africa. The Leakeys, Dr. Stephen Del Marco often told himself, would never have recognized this place, even though it's barely a dozen kilometers from where Lewis and Mary, 5 centuries ago, dug up our first ancestors. Global warming and the little ice age, truncated by miracles of heroic technology, had transformed the landscape and completely altered its biota. Oaks and pine trees were still fighting it out to see which would survive the changes in climactic fortune. And it was hard to believe that, by this year, 2513, there was anything left in the old Divai, undug by enthusiastic anthropologists. However, recent flash floods, which were not supposed to happen anymore, had resculptured this area and cut away several meters of topsoil. Del Marco had taken advantage of the opportunity, and there, at the limit of the deep scan, was something he could not quite believe. It had taken more than a year of slow and careful excavation to reach that ghostly image, and to learn that the reality was stranger than anything he had dared to imagine. Howard Carter, seeing the first glint of gold in Tutankhamun's tomb, had never uncovered such a treasure as this. From this moment onward, Del Marco knew beliefs and philosophies would be irrevocably changed. The monolith appeared to be the exact twin of that discovered earlier. Even the excavation surrounding it was almost identical in size. And like TMA-1, it was totally non-reflective, absorbing the fierce glare of the African sun and the pale gleam of Lucifer with equal indifference. As he led his colleagues, directors of the world's half-dozen most famous museums, 3 eminent anthropologists, the heads of 2 media empires, down into the pit, Del Marco wondered if such a distinguished group of men and women had ever been so silent for so long. But that was the effect that this ebon rectangle had on all visitors, as they realized the implications of the thousands of artifacts that surrounded it. For here was an archaeologist's treasure trove, crudely fashioned flint tools, countless bones, some animal, some human, and almost all arranged in careful patterns. For centuries? No, millennia. These pitiful gifts had been brought here by creatures with only the first glimmer of intelligence, as tribute to a marvel beyond their understanding. And beyond ours, Del Marco had often thought. Yet of 2 things he was certain, though he doubted if proof would ever be possible. This was where, in time and space, the human species had really begun. And this monolith was the very first of all its multitudinous gods. So much to learn, so little time. No, that wasn't true, Poole reminded himself. He might well have a century ahead of him, thanks to the medical science of this age. The thought was already with apprehension rather than pleasure. At least he was now able to follow most conversations easily, and had learned to pronounce words so that Indra was not the only person who could understand him. He was very glad that English was now the world language, though French, Russian, and Mandarin still flourished. I've another problem, Indra, and I guess you're the only person who can help. When I say God, why do people look embarrassed? Indra did not look at all embarrassed. In fact, she laughed. That's a very complicated story. I wish my old friend Dr. Khan were here to explain it to you, but he's on Ganymede, curing any remaining true believers he can find there. When all the old religions were discredited, let me tell you about Pope Pius XX sometime, one of the greatest men in history. We still needed a word for the prime cause, or the creator of the universe, if there is one. There were lots of questions, Dio, Theo, Jove, Brahma. They were all tried, and some of them are still around, especially Einstein's favorite, the old one. But Deus seems to be the fashion nowadays. You said that all the old religions have been discredited. So what do people believe nowadays?
as little as possible. We're all disorthists.
You've lost me. Definitions, please.
They were slightly different in your time, but here are the latest versions. Theists believe that there's not more than one God. Deists that there is not less than one God.
I'm afraid the distinction's too subtle for me.
Not for everyone. You'd be amazed at the bitter controversies it's aroused. By the way, the best-known deists were Americans. Washington, Franklin, Jefferson.
A little before my time, though you'd be surprised how many people don't realize it.
Now, some good news. Joe, Prof. Anderson, has finally given his... what was the phrase? Okay, you're fit enough to be moved to permanent quarters.
That is good news. And here has treated me very well, but I'll be glad to have of my own.
You'll need some new clothes, someone to show you how to wear them, and to help you with the hundreds of little everyday jobs that can waste so much time. So we've taken the liberty of arranging a human personal assistant for you. Come in, Daniil.
Daniil was a small, light brown man in his mid-30s who surprised Poole by not giving him the usual palm-to-palm salute with its automatic exchange of information. Indeed, it soon appeared that Daniil did not possess an ident. Whenever it was needed, he produced a small rectangle of plastic that apparently served the same purpose as the 21st century's smart cards.
Daniil will also be your guide, and... what was the word? I can never remember. Rhymes with ballet. He's been specially trained for the job. I'm sure you'll find him completely satisfactory.
Though Poole appreciated this gesture, it made him feel a little uncomfortable. A valet, indeed. He could not recall ever meeting one. In his time, they were already a rare and endangered species. He began to feel like a character from an early 20th century English novel.
And while Daniil is organizing your move, we'll go for a little trip upstairs, to the Luna level.
Wonderful. How far is that?
Oh, about 12,000 kilometers.
12,000? That'll take hours. Indra looked surprised, then she smiled.
Not as long as you think. No, we don't have a transporter yet, though I believe they're still working on it. So you have a choice, though I know which one you'll take. We can go up on an external elevator and admire the view, or an interior one and enjoy a meal and some light entertainment.
I can't imagine anyone wanting to stay inside.
You'd be surprised. Even mountain climbers who say they've got a head for heights may start to turn green.
I'll risk it. When they had passed through a double set of airlocks in the exterior wall of the tower, they entered what might have been the auditorium of a very small theater. Rows of 10 seats were banked up in 5 tiers. They all faced toward one of the huge picture windows, which Poole still found disconcerting, as he could never quite forget the hundreds of tons of air pressure striving to blast it out into space. The dozen or so other passengers, who had probably never given the matter any thought, seemed perfectly at ease. They all smiled as they recognized him, nodded politely, then turned away to admire the view.
"Welcome to the Sky Lounge," said the inevitable auto voice. "Ascent begins in 5 minutes. You will find refreshments and toilets on the lower floor."
While he was waiting for the ascent to begin, he enjoyed the stunning panorama laid out 2,000 kilometers below. It was winter in the northern hemisphere, but the climate had indeed changed drastically, for there was very little snow south of the Arctic Circle. Europe was almost cloud-free, and there was so much detail that the eye was overwhelmed. One by one he identified the great cities whose names had echoed down the centuries. They had been shrinking, even in his time, as the communications revolution changed the face of the world, and had now dwindled still further. There were also some bodies of water in improbable places. The northern Sahara's Lake Saladin was almost a small sea. Poole was so engrossed by the view that he had forgotten the passage of time. Suddenly he realized that much more than 5 minutes had passed, yet the elevator was still stationary. Had something gone wrong, or were they waiting for late arrivals?
and then he noticed something so extraordinary that at first he refused to believe the evidence of his eyes. The panorama had expanded as if they had already risen hundreds of kilometers. Slowly, understanding dawned in Poole's mind, and also a sense of awestruck wonder. Here indeed was a technology indistinguishable from magic. Some of my friends used to dream of space drives, energy fields that could replace rockets and allow movement without any feeling of acceleration. Most of us thought they were crazy, but it seems they were right. I can still hardly believe it, and unless I'm mistaken, we're starting to lose weight. Yes, it's adjusting to the lunar value. When we step out, you'll feel we're on the moon. But for goodness sake, Frank, forget you're an engineer and simply enjoy the view. It was good advice, but even as he watched the whole of Africa, Europe, and much of Asia flow into his field of vision, Poole could not tear his mind away from this astonishing revelation. Yet he should not have been wholly surprised. He knew that there had been major breakthroughs in space propulsion systems since his time, but had not realized that they would have such dramatic applications to everyday life, if that term could be applied to existence in a 36,000-kilometer-high skyscraper. And the age of the rocket must have been over centuries ago. All his knowledge of propellant systems and combustion chambers, ion thrusters and fusion reactors was totally obsolete. Of course, that no longer mattered. But he understood the sadness that the skipper of a windjammer must have felt when sail gave way to steam. His mood changed abruptly, and he could not help smiling when the auto voice announced, "Arriving in 2 minutes. Please make sure that you do not leave any of your personal belongings behind." How often he had heard that announcement on some commercial flight. He looked at his watch and was surprised to see that they had been ascending for less than half an hour. So that meant an average speed of at least 20,000 kilometers an hour, yet they might never have moved. What was even stranger, for the last 10 minutes or more, they must actually have been decelerating so rapidly that by rights they should all have been standing on the roof, heads pointing toward Earth. The doors opened silently, and as Poole stepped out he felt the slight disorientation he had noticed on entering the elevator lounge. This time, however, he knew what it meant. He was moving through the transition zone where the inertial field overlapped with gravity, at this level, equal to the moon's. Though the view of the receding Earth had been awesome, even for an astronaut, there was nothing unexpected or surprising about it. But who could have imagined a gigantic chamber, apparently occupying the entire width of the tower, so that the far wall was more than 5 kilometers away? Perhaps by this time there were larger enclosed volumes on the Moon and Mars, but this must surely be one of the largest in space. They were standing on a viewing platform, 50 meters up on the outer wall, looking across an astonishingly varied panorama. Obviously, an attempt had been made to reproduce a whole range of terrestrial biomes. Immediately beneath them was a group of slender trees which Poole could not first identify. Then he realized that they were oaks, adapted to 1/6 of their normal gravity. What, he wondered, would palm trees look like here? Giant reeds, probably. In the middle distance there was a small lake, fed by a river that meandered across a grassy plain, then disappeared into something that looked like a single gigantic banyan tree. What was the source of the water? Poole had become aware of a faint drumming sound, and as he swept his gaze along the gently curving wall, he discovered a miniature Niagara with a perfect rainbow hovering in a spray above it. He could have stood there for hours, admiring the view and still not exhausting all the wonders of this complex and brilliantly contrived simulation of the planet below. As it spread out into new and hostile environments, perhaps the human race felt an ever-increasing need to remember its origins. Of course, even in his own time, every city had its parks as, usually feeble, reminders of nature. The same impulse must be acting here, on a much grander scale. Central Park, Africa Tower. "Let's go down," said Indra. "There's so much to see, and I don't come here as often as I'd like."
Though walking was almost effortless in this low gravity, from time to time they took advantage of a small monorail, and stopped once for refreshments at a cafe, cunningly concealed in the trunk of a redwood that must have been at least a quarter of a kilometer tall. There were very few other people about. Their fellow passengers had long since disappeared into the landscape, so it was as if they had all this wonderland to themselves. Everything was so beautifully maintained, presumably by armies of robots, that occasionally Poole was reminded of a visit he had made to Disney World as a small boy. But this was even better. There were no crowds, and indeed very little reminder of the human race and its artifacts. They were admiring a superb collection of orchids, some of enormous size, when Poole had one of the biggest shocks of his life. As they walked past a typical small gardener's shed, the door opened and the gardener emerged. Frank Poole had always prided himself on his self-control and never imagined that as a full-grown adult he would give a cry of pure fright. But like every boy of his generation, he had seen all the Jurassic movies, and he knew a raptor when he met one eye to eye. "I'm terribly sorry," said Indra with obvious concern. "I never thought of warning you." Poole's jangling nerves returned to normal. The dinosaur returned his stare with apparent total disinterest, then doubled back into the shed and emerged again with a rake and a pair of garden shears, which it dropped into a bag hanging over one shoulder. It walked away from them with a bird-like gait, never looking back, as it disappeared behind some 10-meter-high sunflowers. "I should explain," said Indra contritely. "We like to use bioorganisms when we can, rather than robots. I suppose it's, carbon chauvinism. Now, there are only a few animals that have any manual dexterity, and we've used them all at one time or another. And here's a mystery that no one's been able to solve. You'd think that enhanced herbivores like chimps and gorillas would be good at this sort of work. Well, they're not, and they don't have the patience for it. Yet carnivores like our friend here are excellent and easily trained. What's more, here's another paradox, after they've been modified, they're docile and good-natured. Of course, there's almost 1,000 years of genetic engineering behind them, and look what primitive man did to the wolf merely by trial and error." Indra laughed and continued. "You may not believe this, Frank, but they also make good babysitters. Children love them. There's a 500-year-old joke. Would you trust your kids to a dinosaur? What? And risk injuring it?" Poole joined in the laughter, partly in shamefaced reaction to his own fright. To change the subject, he asked Indra the question that was still worrying him. "All this, it's wonderful. But why go to so much trouble when anyone in the tower can reach the real thing just as quickly?" Indra looked at him thoughtfully, weighing her words. "That's not quite true. It's uncomfortable, even dangerous, for anyone who lives above the half-G level to go down to Earth, even in a hover chair." "Not for me, surely. I was born and bred at 1G, and never neglected my exercises aboard Discovery." "You'll have to take that up with Prof. Anderson. Perhaps I shouldn't tell you this, but there's a big argument going on about the current setting of your biological clock. Apparently it never stopped completely, and guesses of your equivalent age range from 50 to 70. Though you're doing fine, you can't expect to regain your full strength after 1,000 years. "Now I begin to understand," Poole told himself bleakly. That explained Anderson's evasiveness and all the muscular reaction tests he'd been doing. "I've come all the way back from Jupiter to within 2,000 kilometers of Earth, but however often I visit it in virtual reality, I may never again walk on the surface of my home planet. I'm not sure how I will be able to handle this." His depression quickly passed. There was so much to do and see. 1,000 lifetimes would not have been enough. And the problem was to choose which of the myriad distractions this age could offer, and to concentrate on the things that mattered, notably his education. the brain cap, and the book-sized player that went with it, inevitably called the brain box, was of enormous value here. He soon had a small library of instant knowledge tablets, each containing all the material needed for a college degree. When he slipped one of these into the brain box and gave it the speed and intensity adjustments that most suited him, there would be a flash of light, followed by a period of unconsciousness that might last as long as an hour. When he awoke, it seemed that new areas of his mind had been opened up, though he only knew they were there when he searched for them. It was almost as if he was the owner of a library who had suddenly discovered shelves of books he did not know he had possessed. To a large extent, he was the master of his own time. Out of a sense of duty and gratitude, he acceded to as many requests as he could from scientists, historians, writers, and artists working in media that were often incomprehensible to him. He also had countless invitations from other citizens of the Four Towers, virtually all of which he was compelled to turn down. Most tempting, and most hard to resist, were those that came from the beautiful planet spread out below. "Of course," Professor Anderson had told him, "you'd survive if you went down for a short time with the right life support system, but you wouldn't enjoy it, and it might weaken your neuromuscular system even further. It's never really recovered from that thousand-year sleep." His other guardian, Indra Wallace, protected him from unnecessary intrusions and advised him which requests he should accept and which he should politely refuse. By himself, he would never understand the socio-political structure of this incredibly complex culture, but he soon gathered that, although in theory all class distinctions had vanished, there were a few thousand super-citizens. George Orwell had been right. Some would always be more equal than others. There had been times when, conditioned by his 21st century experience, Poole had wondered who was paying for all this hospitality. Would he one day be presented with the equivalent of an enormous hotel bill? But Indra had quickly reassured him. He was a unique and priceless museum exhibit, so he would never have to worry about such mundane considerations. Anything he wanted, within reason, would be made available to him. Poole wondered what the limits were, never imagining that one day he would attempt to discover them. All the most important things in life happen by accident, and he had set his wall display browser on random scan, silent, when a striking image caught his attention.
"Stop scan! Sound up!"
he shouted with quite unnecessary loudness. He recognized the music, but it was a few minutes before he identified it. The fact that his wall was filled with winged humans circling gracefully round each other undoubtedly helped, but Tchaikovsky would have been utterly astonished to see this performance of Swan Lake, with the dancers actually flying. Poole watched, entranced. Presumably the ballet was being performed in one of the many low-gravity environments. "I want to try that," Poole decided. He had never quite forgiven the space agency for banning one of his greatest pleasures, delayed parachute formation jumping, even though he could see the agency's point in not wanting to risk a valuable investment. "Well," he thought, "no one to stop me now, unless it's Prof. Anderson." To Poole's relief, the physician thought it was an excellent idea, and he was pleased to find that every one of the towers had its own aviary up at the 1/10 G level. Within a few days, he was being measured for his wings, not in the least like the elegant versions worn by the performers of Swan Lake. Instead, Poole realized that he must look much more like a bat than a bird. For his first lessons, he was taught the basic strokes. Like many acquired skills, it was not quite as easy as it looked. Doubtless his astronaut training helped. He was, the wingmaster told him, the best pupil he had ever taught. The unexciting name, The Aviary, had not prepared him for the venue of his maiden flight. Though it seemed even more enormous than the space holding the forests and gardens down at the lunar G level, it was almost the same size, since it too occupied an entire floor of the gently tapering tower. A circular void, half a kilometer high and over 4 kilometers wide, it appeared truly enormous, as there were no features on it which the eye could rest. Because the walls were a uniform pale blue, they contributed to the impression of infinite space. Poole had not really believed the wingmaster's boast, "You can have any scenery you like," and intended to throw him what he was sure was an impossible challenge. With firm, downward strokes, Poole lifted himself into the air. He would never have believed it possible, even with the technology of this day and age. Better not think about it and follow Indra's advice. Forget you're an engineer and enjoy yourself. He was certainly enjoying himself now, though his pleasure was mixed with an almost overwhelming sense of nostalgia, for he was flying, or so it seemed, at an altitude of about 2 kilometers above the spectacular and unforgotten Flagstaff, Arizona landscape of his youth. Of course the perspective was false, since the aviary was only 0.5 kilometer high, but the illusion was perfect. And there were the whitely gleaming domes of the Lowell Observatory, which he had visited so often as a boy, and whose friendly staff had undoubtedly been responsible for his choice of career. And there, it was incredible, was the little park where he had played with his junior high and high school friends. And then another memory brought tears to his eyes. Along those narrow paths, whenever he could get home from Houston or the moon, he had walked with his beloved Rhodesian Ridgeback, throwing sticks for him to retrieve. Poole had hoped with all his heart that Ricky would still be there to greet him when he returned from Jupiter, and had left him in the care of his younger brother Martin. He almost lost control and sank before regaining stability as he once more faced the bitter truth that both Ricky and Martin had been dust for centuries. When he could see properly again, he became aware that he was not alone in the sky. Something else was approaching, and it was certainly not a human flyer. "Well," he thought, "I'm not particularly surprised to meet a pterodactyl here. Indeed, it's just the sort of thing I'd expect." A pterodactyl was not a bad guess. What was approaching him now was a dragon straight out of fairyland. And to complete the picture, there was a beautiful lady riding on its back. At least Frank assumed she was beautiful. The traditional image was rather spoiled by a large pair of aviator's goggles. Poole hovered in midair like a swimmer treading water. He could not decide whether the oncoming monster was a machine or a bioconstruct, probably both. And then he forgot about the dragon, for the rider removed her goggles. The trouble with clichés, some philosopher remarked, probably with a yawn, is that they are so boringly true. But love at first sight is never boring. Daniil could provide no information, but then Poole had not expected any from him. His ubiquitous escort, he certainly could not pass muster as a classic valet, seemed so limited in his functions that Poole sometimes wondered if he was mentally handicapped, unlikely though that seemed. Daniil understood the functioning of all the household appliances, carried out simple orders with speed and efficiency, and knew his way about the tower. But that was all. It was impossible to have an intelligent conversation with him, and any polite queries about his family were met with a look of blank incomprehension. Poole had even wondered if he too was a bio-robot. Indra, however, gave him the answer he needed right away. "Oh, you've met the dragon lady. Is that what you call her? What's her real name? And can you get me her ident?" "Of course. Now tell me what happened, unless you want to make me jealous." They were now such good friends that they could discuss any subject with perfect frankness. Indeed, they had laughingly lamented their total lack of romantic interest in each other. "First, tell me who she is." "Her name's Aurora Macaulay. Among many other things, she's president of the Society for Creative Anachronisms. And if you thought Draco was impressive, wait until you see some of their other, creations. Like Moby Dick, and a whole zoo full of dinosaurs Mother Nature never thought of." "Oh, this is too good to be true," thought Poole. "I am the biggest anachronism on planet Earth." To Poole's delight, Mistress Macaulay's ident conveyed the information that she was currently between lovers, and he wasted no further time in contacting her. Within 24 hours, he was pillion-riding with his arms enjoyably around her waist. He was not surprised that the ever-changing landscapes below Draco were straight out of legend. Ali Baba had waved angrily at them as they overtook the flying carpet, shouting,
"Can't you see where you're going?"
Yet he must be a long way from Baghdad, because the dreaming spires over which they now circled could only be Oxford. Aurora confirmed his guess as she pointed down.
"Look at the river. That boat coming just out from the bridge. Do you see the two little girls and the clergyman in it?"
"Yes, and I suppose one of them is Alice." Aurora turned and smiled at him over her shoulder.
"Quite correct. She's an accurate replica based on the Reverend's photos. I was afraid you wouldn't know. So many people stopped reading soon after your time."
Poole felt a glow of satisfaction. "I believe I've passed another test," he told himself smugly. "Riding on Draco must have been the first. How many more, I wonder? Fighting with broadswords?" But there were no more, and the answer to the immemorial, "Your place or mine," was Poole's. The next morning, shaken and mortified, he contacted Professor Anderson. Everything was going splendidly, he lamented, when she suddenly became hysterical and pushed me away. I was afraid I'd hurt her somehow.
Go on.
After a few minutes, she relaxed and said something I'll never be able to forget. Anderson waited patiently for Poole to compose himself. She said, "I'm really sorry, Frank. We could have had a good time, but I didn't know that you'd been mutilated." The professor looked baffled, but only for a moment.
"Oh, I understand. I'm sorry, too, Frank. Perhaps I should have warned you. In my 30 years of practice, I've only seen half a dozen cases, all for valid medical reasons, which certainly didn't apply to you. Circumcision made a lot of sense in primitive times, even in your century, as a defense against some unpleasant, even fatal, diseases in backward countries with poor hygiene. But otherwise, there was absolutely no excuse for it, and several arguments against it, as you've just discovered. If you want, it would be easy to arrange a transplant. You wouldn't be making medical history by any means."
"I don't think it would work. Afraid I'd start laughing every time."
"That's the spirit. You're already getting over it."
Somewhat to his surprise, Poole realized that Anderson's prognosis was correct. He even found himself already laughing.
"Now what, Frank?"
"Aurora's Society for Creative Anachronisms. I hoped it would improve my chances. Just my luck to have found one anachronism she doesn't appreciate." Indra was not quite as sympathetic as he'd hoped. Perhaps, after all, there was some sexual jealousy in their relationship. Poole was constantly amazed by Indra's knowledge of his age, as well as by her ignorance of so much that he took for granted. In a way, he had the reverse problem. Even if he lived the 100 years that had been confidently promised him, he could never learn enough to feel at home. In any conversation, there would always be references he did not understand, and jokes that would go over his head. It had not been a good idea to look down on the landscape of his youth. Always at the back of his mind was the knowledge that down there had once lived everyone he had ever loved. Mother, father, dear Uncle George and Aunt Lil, Brother Martin, and not least a succession of dogs, culminating in Ricky. Above all, there was the memory and mystery of Helena. It had begun as a casual affair, but had become more serious as the years went by. Just before he had left for Jupiter, they had planned to make it permanent when he returned. And if he did not, Helena wished to have his child. He still recalled the blend of solemnity and hilarity with which they had made the necessary arrangements. Now, 1,000 years later, despite all his efforts, he had been unable to find if Helena had kept her promise. Just as there were now gaps in his own memory, so there were also in the collective records of mankind. The worst was created by the devastating electromagnetic pulse from the 2304 asteroid impact, which had wiped out several percent of the world's information banks. Poole could not help wondering if the records of his own children were among all the exabytes that were irretrievably lost. Even now his descendants of the 30th generation might be walking the earth, but he would never know. It helped a little to have discovered that, unlike Aurora, some ladies of this era did not consider him to be damaged goods. On the contrary, they often found his alteration quite exciting, but this slightly bizarre reaction made it impossible for Poole to establish any close relationship. Nor was he anxious to do so. All that he really needed was the occasional healthy, mindless exercise. Mindless. That was the trouble. He no longer had any purpose in life. And the weight of too many memories was upon him. Paraphrasing the title of a famous book he had read in his youth, he often said to himself, "I am a stranger in a strange land." There were even occasions when he looked down at the beautiful planet on which, if he obeyed doctor's orders, he could never walk again, and wondered what it would be like to make a second acquaintance with the vacuum of space. Though it was not easy to get through the airlocks without triggering some alarm, it had been done. Every few years, some determined suicide made a brief, meteoric display in the Earth's atmosphere. Perhaps it was just as well that deliverance was on its way, from a completely unexpected direction.
"Nice to meet you, Commander Poole, for the second time.
I'm sorry, don't recall, but then I see so many people."
"No need to apologize. First time was out round Neptune."
"Captain Chandler, delighted to see you. And what are you doing back on Earth? They told me you never come inside Mars orbit."
"Almost true. Though I was born here, I think it's a dirty, smelly place. Too many people. Creeping up to 1 billion again."
"More than 10 billion in my time. By the way, did you get my thank you message?"
"Yes, and I know I should have contacted you, but I waited until I headed sunward again. So here I am."
Poole tried to analyze his visitor. Beards, even small goatees like Chandler's, were very rare in this society, and he had never known an astronaut who wore one. They did not coexist comfortably with space helmets. It was obvious that Chandler was something of an eccentric, and Poole's heart warmed to him. "You've not answered my question. If you don't like Earth, what are you doing here?"
"Oh, my old rust bucket is having a refit up at the Rim shipyard, and the armor has to be replaced."
"Armor?"
"Dust shield. Not such a problem in your time, was it? But it's a dirty environment out round Jupiter, and our normal cruise speed is several thousand clicks a second, so there's a continuous gentle pattering, like raindrops on the roof."
"You're joking."
"Course I am. If we really could hear anything, we'd be dead. Luckily, this sort of unpleasantness is very rare. Last serious accident was 20 years ago. We know all the main comet streams, where most of the junk is, and are careful to avoid them, except when we're matching velocity to round up ice. But why don't you come aboard and have a look around before we take off for Jupiter?"
"I'd be delighted. Did you say Jupiter?"
"Well, Ganymede, of course. Anubis City. We've a lot of business there, and several of us have families they haven't seen for months."
Poole scarcely heard him. Suddenly, unexpectedly, and perhaps none too soon, he had found a reason for living. Commander Frank Poole was the sort of man who hated to leave a job undone, and a few specks of cosmic dust were not likely to discourage him. He had unfinished business at the world once known as Jupiter. "Anything you want, within reason," he had been told. Frank Poole was not sure if his hosts would consider that returning to Jupiter was a reasonable request. Indeed, he was not quite sure himself, and was beginning to have second thoughts. He had already committed himself to scores of engagements, weeks in advance. However, he was relieved, and a little surprised, when both Indra and Professor Anderson agreed it was an excellent idea. For the first time, he realized that they had been concerned with his mental health. Perhaps a holiday from Earth would be the best possible cure. And, most important of all, Captain Chandler was delighted. There were times when Poole wondered if Chandler, with his beard and swagger, was not another anachronism. He could easily picture him on the bridge of a battered three-master with skull and crossbones flying overhead. Once his decision had been made, events moved with surprising speed. He had accumulated very few possessions, and fewer still that he needed to take with him. The most important was Miss Pringle, his electronic alter ego and secretary, now the storehouse of both his lives and the small stack of terabyte memories that went with her. Miss Pringle was not much larger than the handheld personal assistants of his own age, and usually lived in a quick-draw holster at his waist. She could communicate with him by audio or brain cap, and her prime duty was to act as an information filter and a buffer to the outside world. Like any good secretary, she knew when to reply, "I'll put you through now," or much more frequently, "I'm sorry, Mr. Poole is engaged. Please record your message." There were very few farewells to be made, though real-time conversations would be impossible owing to the sluggish velocity of radio waves. He would be in constant touch with Indra and Joe, the only genuine friends he had made. Somewhat to his surprise, Poole realized that he would miss his enigmatic but useful valet, because he would now have to handle all the small chores of everyday life by himself. Daniil bowed slightly when they parted, but otherwise showed no sign of emotion. As they took the long ride up to the outer curve of the world-circling wheel, 36,000 kilometers above Central Africa. "I'm not sure, Dim, that you'll appreciate the comparison, but do you know what Goliath reminds me of?" They were now such good friends that Poole could use the captain's nickname.
"Something unflattering, I assume."
"Not really, but when I was a boy, I came across a whole pile of old science fiction magazines. They had wonderful garish covers showing strange planets and monsters, and of course, spaceships. As I grew older, I realized how ridiculous those spaceships were. They were usually rocket-driven, but there was never any sign of propellant tanks. There was one favorite of mine with a huge glass dome, a space-going conservatory." "Well, those old artists had the last laugh. Goliath looks more like their dreams than the flying fuel tanks we used to launch from the Cape. Your inertial drive still seems too good to be true. No visible means of support. Unlimited range and speed. Sometimes I think I'm the one who's dreaming." Chandler laughed and pointed to the view outside.
"Does that look like a dream?"
It was the first time that Poole had seen a genuine horizon since he had come to Star City, and it was not quite as far away as he had expected. He was on the outer rim of a wheel 7 times the diameter of Earth, and the view across the roof of his artificial world extended for just over 25 kilometers. Even knowing perfectly well what to expect, it was uncanny to watch vessels many times the size of his long-lost discovery lifting off with no apparent means of propulsion. Strangest of all, though, was to sit up here on the rim, in the geostationary orbit itself, and to feel weight. Here, inside Goliath, the inertial field was maintaining standard Mars G.
"Sure you don't want to change your mind, Frank?" Captain Chandler asked jokingly as he left for the bridge. "Still 10 minutes before liftoff." "Wouldn't be very popular if I did, would I? No, as they used to say back in the old days, we have commit."
Poole felt the need to be alone when the drive went on, and the tiny crew, only 4 men and 3 women, respected his wish. Perhaps they guessed how he must be feeling to leave Earth for the 2nd time in 1,000 years, and once again to face an unknown destiny. Jupiter Lucifer was on the other side of the sun, and the almost straight line of Goliath's orbit would take them close to Venus. Poole looked forward to seeing, with his own unaided eyes, if Earth's sister planet was now beginning to live up to that description, after centuries of terraforming. From 1,000 kilometers up, Star City looked like a gigantic metal band around the Earth's equator. It was diminishing swiftly as Goliath headed sunward. And now they were falling below the plane of the ring. It was midwinter in the northern hemisphere, so the slim halo of Star City was inclined at over 20 degrees to the sun. Already Poole could see the American and Asian towers as shining threads stretching outward and away beyond the blue haze of the atmosphere. The Earth, almost full, still spanned the field of view, and he could now see the full length of the Africa Tower, which had been his home in the life he was now leaving. Perhaps, he could not help thinking, forever. Morning, they were already at Venus, but the huge, dazzling crescent of the still cloud-wrapped planet was not the most striking object in the sky. Goliath was floating above an endless expanse of crinkled silver foil, flashing in the sunlight with ever-changing patterns as the ship drifted across it. Poole remembered that in his own age there had been an artist who had wrapped whole buildings in plastic sheets. How he would have loved this opportunity to package billions of tons of ice in a glittering envelope. Only in this way could the core of a comet be protected from evaporation on its decades-long journey sunward.
"You're in luck, Frank," Chandler had told him. "This is something I've never seen myself. It should be spectacular. Impact due in just over an hour. We've given it a little nudge to make sure it comes down in the right place. Don't want anyone to get hurt."
Poole looked at him in astonishment. "You mean there are already people on Venus?"
"About 50 mad scientists near the South Pole. They're well dug in, but we should shake them up a bit, even though Ground Zero is on the other side of the planet. Or I should say, Atmosphere Zero. It will be days before anything except the shock wave gets down to the surface."
As the cosmic iceberg, sparkling and flashing in its protective envelope, dwindled away toward Venus, the radar image of the tortured Venusian landscape, its weird volcanoes, pancake domes, and narrow, sinuous canyons, dominated the main screen of Goliath's control center, but Poole preferred the evidence of his own eyes. Although the unbroken sea of clouds that covered the planet revealed nothing of the inferno beneath, he wanted to see what would happen when the stolen comet struck. In a matter of seconds, the myriads of tons of frozen hydrates that had been gathering speed for decades on the downhill run from Neptune would deliver all their energy. The initial flash was even brighter than he had expected. How strange that a missile made of ice could generate temperatures that must be in the tens of thousands of degrees. The fierce blue of the fireball proclaimed that it was hotter than the sun. It was cooling rapidly as it expanded, through yellow, orange, red. The shock wave would now be spreading outward at the velocity of sound. And what a sound that must be. So in a few minutes there should be some visible indication of its passage across the face of Venus. And there it was. Only a tiny black ring, like an insignificant puff of smoke giving no hint of the cyclonic fury that must be blasting its way upward from the point of impact. Captain Chandler's voice sounded briskly over the ship's address system.
"Putting you through to Aphrodite base. Glad to say they're not shouting for help." "Shook us up a bit, but just what we expected. Monitors indicate some rain already over the Nokomis Mountains, and there seems to have been a flash flood in the Hecate Chasm. There was a temporary lake boiling water there after the last delivery, and thanks again for bringing this little load down place. With any luck, and if we can get that sunscreen up into sync orbit, we'll have some permanent seas before long, and then we could plant coral reefs. Hope I live to see it."
"I hope you do," thought Poole in silent admiration. Miss Pringle. File, Wallace. "Hello, Indra. Yes, Chandler and I get along fine, and at first the crew treated me, this will amuse you, rather like a holy relic. But they're beginning to accept me, and have even started to pull my leg. Do you know that idiom? It's annoying not to be able to have a real conversation, but there's one advantage. You won't be able to interrupt me. Even though it will take us only a week to reach Jupiter, I thought I'd have time to relax. Not a bit of it. My fingers started to itch, and I couldn't resist going back to school. So I've begun basic training all over again in one of Goliath's mini-shuttles. Maybe Dim will actually let me solo." "Hello, Frank. Indra calling. You mentioned Daniil. Sorry, we always evaded your questions about him. Knew you were curious, but we have very good reason. Remember you once called him a non-person? Not a bad guess. Once you asked me about crime nowadays. I don't know what Daniil's crime was. Wouldn't tell you if I did. Very hard to get people for some jobs. Don't know how we'd manage if crime level zero. Anyway, hope he's soon decontrolled and back in normal society.
regards to Dmitri. You must be halfway to Ganymede now. Wonder if they'll ever repeal Einstein so we can talk across space in real time. Hello, Frank. Here I am again. It's an acknowledgement of my last. Strange you should be heading toward Ganymede and my old friend Ted Kahn. But perhaps it's not such a coincidence. He was drawn by the same enigma that you were. Don't know anyone else who's developed such an interest in religion. No. Obsession. Anyway, give him my regards, and don't, repeat, don't get into any arguments with him. Love and best wishes from Africa Tower. The arrival of such a distinguished passenger had caused a certain disruption in the tight little world of Goliath, but the crew had adapted to it with good humor. Every day at 1800 hours, all personnel gathered for dinner in the wardroom. During the 10-day voyage, as he listened to the stories, jokes, and complaints of his temporary shipmates, Poole learned more about the solar system than during his months on Earth. All aboard were obviously delighted to have a new and perhaps naive listener as an attentive one-man audience, but Poole was seldom taken in by their more imaginative stories. Yet sometimes it was hard to know where to draw the line. No one really believed in the golden asteroid, which was usually regarded as a 24th-century hoax. But what about the Mercurian plasmoids, which had been reported by at least a dozen reliable witnesses during the last 500 years? The simplest explanation was that they were related to ball lightning, responsible for so many unidentified flying objects reports on Earth and Mars. But some observers swore that they had shown purposefulness, even inquisitiveness, when they were encountered at close quarters. Inevitably, this led to discussions about life in the universe, and Poole found himself, not for the first time, defending his own era against its extremes of credulity and skepticism. Although the Aliens Are Among Us mania had already ended when he was a boy, even as late as the 2020s, the space agency was still plagued by lunatics who claimed to have been contacted or abducted by visitors from other worlds. Their delusions had been reinforced by sensational media exploitation, and the whole syndrome was later enshrined in the medical literature as Adamski's disease. The discovery of TMA-1 had paradoxically put an end to this sorry nonsense by demonstrating that though there was indeed intelligence elsewhere, it had apparently not concerned itself with mankind for several million years. The crew's knowledge of third millennium history was so surprisingly limited that Poole, thanks to the intensive education he had received in Star City, could often amaze them with details of events centuries after his own time. However, he was flattered to discover how well acquainted they were with Discovery's log. It had become one of the classic records of the space age. They looked on it as he might have regarded a Viking saga. Often he had to remind himself that he was midway in time between Goliath and the first ships to cross the Western Ocean.
"On your day 86, one of the crew reminded him at dinner on the fifth evening, "you passed within 2,000 K of asteroid 7,794 and shot a probe into it. Do you remember?"
"Of course I do," Poole answered rather brusquely. "To me, it happened less than a year ago."
Sorry. "Well, tomorrow we'll be even closer to 13,445. Like to have a look? With auto-guidance and freeze frame, we should have a window all of 10 milliseconds wide."
1/100 of a second. The few minutes in Discovery had seemed hectic enough.
"Sorry, we don't have a slug to fire at it. Did you ever wonder if 7794 would hit back?"
"Never occurred to us, but it did give the astronomers a lot of useful information, so it was worth the risk. Anyway, 1/100 of a second hardly seems worth the bother. Thanks, all the same." Poole was 1,000 years in the past, recalling the only excitement of Discovery's mission before the final disaster. Though he and Bowman were perfectly aware that 7794 was merely a lifeless, airless chunk of rock, that knowledge scarcely affected their feelings. It was the only solid matter they would meet this side of Jupiter, and they had stared at it with the emotions of sailors on a long sea voyage, skirting a coast on which they could not land. He remembered also the mounting tension as they waited to see if their aim had been accurate.
It was not easy to hit such a small target 2,000 kilometers away, moving at a relative velocity of 20 kilometers a second. Then, against the darkened portion of the asteroid, there had been a sudden, dazzling explosion of light. The tiny slug, pure uranium-238, had impacted at meteoric speed. In a fraction of a second, all its kinetic energy had been transformed into heat. A puff of incandescent gas had erupted briefly into space, and Discovery's cameras were recording their rapidly fading spectral lines, looking for the telltale signatures of glowing atoms. A few hours later, back on Earth, the astronomers learned for the first time the composition of an asteroid's crust. There were no major surprises. This voyage, with Captain Chandler, had been as uneventful as any skipper could have hoped, when the new son of Lucifer dominated the sky ahead. Extract from Tourist's Guide to Outer Solar System. Even today, the giant satellites of what was once Jupiter present us with major mysteries. Why are four worlds, orbiting the same primary, and very similar in size, so different in most other respects? Only in the case of Io, the innermost satellite, is there a convincing explanation. It is so close to Jupiter that the gravitational tides constantly kneading its interior generate colossal quantities of heat, so much indeed that Io's surface is semi-molten. Though no permanent human bases have ever been established in such an unstable environment, there have been numerous landings and there is continuous robot monitoring. Europa, second in distance from Jupiter, was originally covered in ice and showed few surface features except a complicated network of cracks. The tidal forces which dominate Io were much less powerful here, but produced enough heat to give Europa a global ocean of liquid water in which many strange life forms have evolved. Since the conversion of Jupiter into the mini-sun Lucifer, virtually all of Europa's ice cover has melted, and extensive volcanism has created several small islands. As is well known, there have been no landings on Europa for almost 1,000 years, but the satellite is under continuous surveillance. Ganymede, the largest moon in the solar system, has also been affected by the creation of a new sun, and its equatorial regions are warm enough to sustain terrestrial life forms, though it does not yet have a breathable atmosphere. Most of its population is actively engaged in terraforming and scientific research. The main settlement is Anubis City, population 41,000, near the South Pole. Callisto is again wholly different. Its entire surface is covered by impact craters of all sizes, so numerous that they overlap. There is no permanent base on Callisto, but several automatic stations have been established there. It was unusual for Frank Poole to oversleep, but he had been kept awake by strange dreams, past and prestricably mixed. Sometimes he was on Discovery, sometimes in the Africa Tower, and sometimes he was a boy again amongst friends he had thought long forgotten. "Where am I?" he asked himself as he struggled up to consciousness, like a swimmer trying to get back to the surface. There was a small window just above his bed. He drew the curtain and looked out. No, he had not awakened in the skies of Earth, though the landscape unfolding below was not unlike the Antarctic. But the South Pole had never boasted two suns, both rising at once as Goliath swept toward them. The ship was orbiting less than 100 kilometers above what appeared to be an immense plowed field, lightly dusted with snow. "So, this is Ganymede," Poole wondered drowsily. "Mankind's furthest outpost from home. Why should any sensible person want to live here? Well, I've often thought that when I've flown over Greenland or Iceland in wintertime." The Grand Ganymede Hotel, inevitably known throughout the solar system as Hotel Ganymede, was certainly not grand, and would be lucky to get a rating of 1.5 stars on Earth. As the nearest competition was several 100 million kilometers away, the management felt little need to exert itself unduly. Yet Poole had no complaints, though he often wished that Daniil was still around to help him with the mechanics of life. Perhaps the naming of the Ganymede's only luxury suite was inevitable, but it had been a real shock to meet an ancient life-size hollow of his old shipmate, in full dress uniform, as he was led into the Bowman suite. Poole even recognized the image. His own official portrait had been made at the same time, a few days before the mission began. He soon discovered that most of his Goliath crewmates had domestic arrangements in Anubis, and were anxious for him to meet their significant others during the ship's planned 20-day stop. Almost immediately he was caught up in the social and professional life of this frontier settlement, and it was Africa Tower that now seemed a distant dream. Like many Americans, in their secret hearts, Poole had a nostalgic affection for small communities where everyone knew everyone else. Anubis, with a resident population less than that of his remembered Flagstaff, was not a bad approximation of this ideal. The three main pressure domes, each 2 kilometers in diameter, stood on a plateau overlooking an ice field which stretched unbroken to the horizon. Ganymede's second sun, once known as Jupiter, would never give sufficient heat to melt the polar caps. This was the principal reason for establishing Anubis in such an inhospitable spot. The city's foundations were not likely to collapse for at least several centuries. And inside the domes, it was easy to be completely indifferent to the outside world. Poole, when he had mastered the mechanisms of the Bowman suite, discovered that he had a limited but impressive choice of environments. To his great regret, he had never been to Egypt, so it was delightful to relax beneath the gaze of the Sphinx and to watch tourists scrambling up the massive blocks of the Great Pyramid. The illusion was perfect, apart from the no-man's land where the desert clashed with the slightly worn carpet of the Bowman suite. The sky, however, was one that no human eyes had seen until 5,000 years after the last stone was laid at Giza. But it was not an illusion. It was the complex and ever-changing reality of Ganymede. Because this world, like its companions, had been robbed of its spin eons ago by the tidal drag of Jupiter, the new sun born from the giant planet hung motionless in its sky. Since Ganymede's newborn atmosphere was still extremely thin and almost cloudless, the parade of heavenly bodies provided a never-ending spectacle. Closest, Io and Callisto, each appeared about half the size of the moon as seen from Earth. But that was the only thing they had in common. Io was so close to Lucifer, it took less than 2 days to race around its orbit, and showed visible movement even in a matter of minutes. Callisto, at over 4 times Io's distance, required 16 days to complete its leisurely circuit. The physical contrast between the two worlds was even more remarkable. Deep-frozen Callisto had been almost unchanged by Jupiter's conversion into a mini-sun, while on Io, something was happening every week. Sometimes incandescent fountains would soar briefly hundreds of kilometers into space, like gigantic trees of fire growing on a lifeless world. Before the dawn of the space age, no one had ever imagined that such a world existed. Fascinating though it was to observe it from his comfortable vantage point, Poole found it hard to believe that men had ever risked landing there, where even robots feared to tread. His main interest, however, was Europa, which at its closest appeared almost exactly the same size as Earth's solitary moon, but raced through its phases in only 4 days. Though Poole had been quite unconscious of the symbolism when he chose his private landscape, it now seemed wholly appropriate that Europa should hang in the sky above another great enigma, the Sphinx. Poole could see how greatly Europa had changed in the 1,000 years since Discovery had set out for Jupiter. The spider's web of narrow bands and lines that had once completely enveloped the smallest of the 4 Galilean satellites had vanished, except around the poles. Here the global crust of kilometer-thick ice remained unmelted by the warmth of Europa's new sun. Elsewhere, virgin oceans seethed and boiled in the thin atmosphere at what would have been comfortable room temperature on Earth. It was also a comfortable temperature to the creatures who had emerged after the melt-broken ice shield that had both trapped and protected them. Orbiting spysats, showing details only centimeters across, had watched one European species starting to evolve into an amphibious stage. Though they still spent much of their time underwater, the Europes had even begun the construction of simple buildings. That this could happen in a mere 1,000 years was astonishing. But no one doubted that the explanation lay in the last and greatest of the monoliths, the many-kilometer-long Great Wall standing on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And no one doubted that, in its own mysterious way, it was watching over the experiment it had started on this world, as it had done on Earth
4 million years before. Miss Pringle, file, Indra. My dear Indra, to answer your question, yes, I'm now feeling quite at home at the Granny-mead, but this may sound silly. I'm still not used to being in the Bowman suite. I keep looking over my shoulder. How do I spend my time? Much the same as in Africa Tower. I'm meeting the local intelligentsia, though as you might expect, they're rather thin on the ground. And I'm sorry, I still haven't met Dr. Khan, though he's left several messages for me. I promise to do it in the next few days. Best wishes to Joe. Regards to Daniil, if you know what's happened to him. Is he a real person again? And my love to yourself. Back in Poole's century, a person's name often gave a clue to his or her appearance, but that was no longer true 30 generations later. Dr. Theodore Kahn turned out to be a Nordic blonde who might have looked more at home in a Viking longboat than ravaging the steppes of Central Asia. However, he could not have been too impressive in either role, being less than 150 centimeters tall. Anubis City was far too small to boast a university campus. Instead, it had something appropriate, as well as centuries older. An academy, complete with a grove of olive trees that would have fooled Plato himself until he had attempted to walk through it. "It's built to hold 7 people, said Dr. Kahn proudly, when they'd settled down on chairs obviously designed to be not too comfortable, because that's the maximum one can efficiently interact with. You know, I still can't credit my luck. Your arrival here almost tempts me to believe in miracles. I'd even thought of going to Earth to meet you. Has dear Indra told you about my, obsession? No, Poole answered, not altogether truthfully. Dr. Kahn looked very pleased. He was clearly delighted to find a new audience. You may have heard me called an atheist, but that's not quite true. Atheism is unprovable, so uninteresting. My field of interest is the psychopathology known as religion. Psychopathology? That's a harsh judgment. Amply justified by history, where we can find millions who would fight to the death against equally deluded believers of a microscopically differing faith. Would you argue that anyone with strong religious beliefs was insane? In a strictly technical sense, yes, if they really were sincere and not hypocrites. And how do you account for this? The only real genius I ever met was Dr. Chandra, who led the HAL project. I once had to go into his office. There was no reply when I knocked. I thought it was unoccupied. He was praying to a group of fantastic little bronze statues draped with flowers. One of them looked like an elephant. I was quite embarrassed, but luckily he didn't hear me, and I tiptoed out. Would you say he was insane?
You've chosen a bad example. Genius often is. So let's say, not insane, but mentally impaired owing to childhood conditioning. The Jesuits claimed, give me a boy for 6 years and he is mine for life. If they'd got hold of little Chandra in time, he'd have been a devout Catholic, not a Hindu.
Possibly, but I'm puzzled. Why were you so anxious to meet me? I'm afraid I've never been a devout anything. What have I got to do with all this? Slowly, and with the obvious enjoyment of a man unburdening himself of a heavy, long-hoarded secret, Dr. Kahn told him. Hello, Frank. So you finally met Ted. Yes, you could call him a crank, if you define that as an enthusiast with no sense of humor. But cranks often get that way because they know a big truth. Can you hear my capitals? And no one will listen. I'm glad you did, and I suggest you take him quite seriously. But you still haven't told me how Ted, that old crypto-deist, thinks you can help him search for God. Love, Indra. Miss Pringle, record. Hello, Indra. I've had another session with Dr. Ted. Why is he so delighted that I'm here? As you know, he's convinced that the key to many mysteries lies on Europa, where no one has been out of land for 1,000 years. He thinks I may be an exception. He believes I have a friend there. Yes, Dave Bowman, or whatever he's now become. We know that he survived drawn into the Big Brother monolith and somehow revisited Earth afterward, but there's more that I didn't know. Very few people do, because the Meads are embarrassed to talk about it. Ted Kahn has spent years collecting the evidence and is now quite certain of the facts, even though he can't explain them. On at least 6 occasions, about a century apart, reliable observers here in Anubis have reported seeing an apparition
just like the one that Haywood Floyd met aboard Discovery. Though not one of them knew about that incident, all able to identify Dave when they were shown his hologram. And there was another sighting aboard a survey ship that made a close approach to Europa 600 years ago. Individually, no one would take these cases seriously, but all together, they make a pattern. Ted's quite sure that Dave Bowman survives in some form, presumably associated with the monolith we call the Great Wall, and he still has some interest in our affairs. Though he's made no attempt at communication, Ted hopes we can make contact. He believes that I'm the only human who can do it. I'm still trying to make up my mind. Tomorrow, I'll talk it over with Captain Chandler. We'll let you know what we decide. Love, Frank. Do you believe in ghosts, Dim?
Certainly not. Why, like every sensible man, I'm afraid of them. Why do you ask?
If it wasn't a ghost, it was the most vivid dream I've ever had. Last night, I had a conversation with Dave Bowman.
Interesting, but there's an obvious explanation. You've been living here in the Bowman suite for Deus' sake. You told me yourself it feels haunted.
I'm sure, well, 99% sure that you're right, and the whole thing was prompted by the discussions I've been having with Prof. Ted. Have you heard the reports that Dave Bowman occasionally appears in Anubis, about once every 100 years? Just as he did to Dr. Floyd aboard Discovery, after she'd been reactivated.
What happened there? I've heard vague stories, but never taken them seriously.
Dr. Kahn does, so do I. I've seen original recordings. Floyd sitting in my old chair when a kind of dust cloud forms behind him and shapes itself into Dave's head. Then it gives that famous message warning him to leave.
Who wouldn't? But that was 1,000 years ago. Plenty of time to fake it.
What would be the point? Kahn and I were looking at it yesterday. I'll bet my life it's authentic.
As a matter of fact, I agree with you, and I've heard those reports. Anyway, why is Professor Ted interested?
That's what I really wanted to discuss with you. Ted thinks that Dave Bowman, or whatever he's become, may still exist, up there on Europa.
After 1,000 years?
Look at me.
One sample is poor statistics, my math prof used to say, but go on.
It's a complicated story, or maybe most of the pieces missing, but it's generally agreed that something crucial happened to our ancestors when that monolith appeared in Africa 4 million years ago. It marks a turning point in prehistory, the first appearance of tools and weapons and religion. That can't be pure coincidence. The monolith must have done something to us. Surely it couldn't have just stood there, passively accepting worship. Ted's fond of quoting a famous paleontologist who said TMA0 gave us an evolutionary kick in the pants. He argues that the kick wasn't in a wholly desirable direction. Did we have to become so mean and nasty to survive? Maybe we did. All creatures need a certain amount of aggressiveness to survive, but we seem to have far more than is absolutely necessary. And no other animal tortures its fellow as we do. Is this an evolutionary accident, a piece of genetic bad luck? It's also widely agreed that TMA-1 was planted on the moon to keep track of the project, experiment, whatever it was, and to report to Jupiter, the obvious place for solar system mission control. That's why another monolith, Big Brother, was waiting there, had been waiting 4 million years when Discovery arrived.
Yes, I've always thought that that was the most plausible theory.
Now, for the more speculative stuff. Bowman was apparently swallowed up by Big Brother, yet something of his personality seems to have survived. 20 years after that encounter with Haywood Floyd in the second Jupiter expedition, they had another contact aboard Universe, when Floyd joined it for the 2061 rendezvous with Halley's Comet. At least his memoirs, though he was well over 100 when he dictated them.
Could have been senile.
Not according to all the contemporary accounts. Also, perhaps even more significant, his grandson Chris had some equally weird experiences when Galaxy made its forced landing on Europa. And of course, that's where the monolith, or a monolith, is right now, surrounded by Europans.
I'm beginning to see what Dr. Ted's driving at. This is where we came in. The whole cycle's starting over again. The Europes are being groomed for stardom.
Exactly. Everything fits. Jupiter ignited to give them a sun, to thaw out their frozen world. The warning to us to keep our distance, presumably so that we wouldn't interfere with their development.
Where have I heard that idea before? Of course, Frank, it goes back 1,000 years, to your own time. The Prime Directive. We still get lots of laughs from those old Star Trek programs.
Did I ever tell you I once met some of the actors? They would have been surprised to see me now. And I've always had two thoughts about that non-interference policy. The monolith certainly violated it with us back there in Africa. One might argue that did have disastrous results.
So, better luck next time on Europa.
Poole laughed without much humor. Khan used those exact words.
And what does he think we should do about it? Above all, where do you come into the picture?
First of all, we must find what's really happening on Europa, and why. Merely observing it from space is not enough.
What else can we do? All the probes the Medes have sent there were blown up just before landing.
And ever since the mission to rescue Galaxy, crew-carrying ships have been diverted by some field of force which no one could figure out. It's very interesting. It proves that whatever is down there is protective, but not malevolent. And this is the important point. It must have some way of scanning what's on the way. It can distinguish between robots and humans.
More than I can do sometimes. Go on.
Well, Ted thinks there's one human being who might make it down to the surface of Europa, because his old friend is there and may have some influence with the powers that be. Captain Dimitri Chandler gave a long, low whistle.
And you're willing to risk it?
Yes, what got to lose?
One valuable shuttlecraft, if I know what you have in mind. Is that why you've been learning to fly, Falcon?
Well, now that you mention it, the idea had occurred to me.
I'll have to think it over. I admit I'm intrigued, but there are lots of problems.
Knowing you, I'm sure they won't stand in the way, once you've decided to help me. Miss Pringle, record. Dear Indra, I'm not trying to be dramatic, but this may be my last message from Ganymede. By the time you receive it, I will be on my way to Europa. Though it's a sudden decision, I've thought it over very carefully. As you have guessed, Ted Khan is largely responsible. Let him do the explaining if I don't come back. Please don't misunderstand me. In no way do I regard this as a suicide mission. But I'm 90% convinced by Ted's arguments, and he's aroused my curiosity so much that I'd never forgive myself if I turned down this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Maybe I should say once-in-two lifetimes. I'm flying Goliath's little one-person shuttle, Falcon. Judging by past records, the most likely outcome is that I'll be diverted away from Europa before I can land. Even this will teach me something. And if it, presumably the local monolith, the Great Wall, decides to treat me like the robot probes it zapped in the past, I'll never know. That's a risk I'm prepared to take. Thank you for everything, and my very best to Joe. Love from Ganymede, and soon, I hope, from Europa.
Europa's about 400,000 K from Ganymede at the moment, Captain Chandler informed Poole. If you stepped on the gas... Thanks for teaching me that phrase. Falcon could get you there in an hour, but I wouldn't recommend it. Our mysterious friend might be alarmed by anyone coming in that fast.
Agreed. And I want time to think. I'm going to take several hours at least, and I'm still hoping... Poole's voice trailed off.
Hoping what?
That I can make some sort of contact with Dave, or whatever it is, before I attempt to land.
Yes, it's always rude to drop in uninvited, even with people you know, let alone perfect strangers like the Europes. Perhaps you should take some gifts. What did the old-time explorers use? I believe mirrors and beads were once popular.
Chandler's facetious tone did not disguise his real concern, both for Poole and for the valuable piece of equipment he proposed to borrow, and for which the skipper of Goliath was ultimately responsible.
I'm still trying to decide how we work this. If you come back a hero, I want to bask in your reflected glory. But if you lose Falcon, as well as yourself, what shall I say? That you stole the shuttle while we weren't looking? I'm afraid no one would buy that story. Ganymede traffic control's very efficient. Has to be. If you left without advance notice, they'd be on to you in a millisecond. No way you could leave unless I file your flight plan ahead of time. So this is what I propose to do. You're taking Falcon out for a final qualification test. Everyone knows you've already soloed. You'll go into a 2,000-kilometer-high orbit above Europa. Nothing unusual about that. People do it all the time. Estimated total flight time, 5 hours. If you suddenly change your mind about coming home, no one can do anything about it. Of course, I'll make some indignant noises and say how astonished I am by such gross navigational errors, etc., etc., whatever will look best in the subsequent court of inquiry.
Would it come to that? I don't want to do anything that would get you into trouble.
Don't worry. It's time there was a little excitement round here. But only you and I know about this plot. Try not mention it to the crew. I want them to have, what was that other useful expression you taught me? Plausible deniability.
Thanks, Dim. I really appreciate what you're doing. And I hope you'll never have to regret hauling me aboard Goliath, out round Neptune.
Manual control, please.
Are you sure, Frank?
Quite sure, Falcon. Thank you. Illogical though it seemed, most of the human race had found it impossible not to be polite to its artificial children, however simple-minded they might be. Whole volumes of psychology, as well as popular guides, had been written on the subject of man-machine etiquette. Long ago it had been decided that, however inconsequential rudeness to robots might appear to be, it should be discouraged. All too easily, it could spread to human relationships as well. Falcon was now in orbit, just as her flight plan had promised, at a safe 2,000 kilometers above Europa. Poole needed no optical aid to see his planned destination, on the still icy shore of the Sea of Galilee, not far from the skeleton of the first spacecraft to land on this world. Though the Europans had long ago removed all its metal components, the ill-fated Chinese ship still served as a memorial to its crew, and it was appropriate that the only town, even if an alien one, on this whole world should have been named Cienville. Poole had decided to come down over the sea and then fly very slowly toward Cienville, hoping that this approach would appear friendly, or at least non-aggressive. Though he admitted to himself that this was very naive, he could think of no better alternative. Then suddenly, just as he was dropping below the 1,000-kilometer level, there was an interruption. Not the kind he had hoped for, but one which he had been expecting.
This is Ganymede Control calling Falcon. You have departed from your flight plan. Please advise immediately what is happening.
It was hard to ignore such an urgent request, but in the circumstances, it seemed the best thing to do. Exactly 30 seconds later, and 100 kilometers closer to Europa, Ganymede repeated its message. Once again, Poole ignored it. But Falcon did not.
Are you quite sure you want to do this, Frank? Asked the shuttle.
Though Poole knew perfectly well that he was imagining it, he would have sworn that there was a note of anxiety in its voice.
Quite sure, Falcon. I know exactly what I'm doing.
This was certainly untrue, and any moment now further lying might be necessary to a more sophisticated audience.
This is Ganymede Control. Do you receive me, Falcon? You are operating on manual override, so I am unable to assist you. What is happening? You are still descending toward Europa. Please acknowledge immediately.
Poole began to experience mild twinges of conscience. The controller sounded genuinely alarmed. Suddenly, he knew how to relieve their anxiety, as well as to attempt something which he had previously dismissed as altogether too absurd. Perhaps, after all, it was worth a try. It certainly wouldn't do any harm, and it might even work.
This is Frank Poole calling from Falcon. I am perfectly okay, but something seems to have taken over the controls and is bringing the shuttle down toward Europa. I hope you are receiving this. I will continue to report as long as possible.
Well, he hadn't actually lied to the worried controller, and one day he hoped he would be able to face him with a clear conscience. He continued to talk, trying to sound if he was completely sincere, instead skirting the edge of truth.
I repeat, this is Frank Poole aboard the shuttle Falcon, descending toward Europa. I assume that some outside force has taken charge of my spacecraft and will be landing it safely.
Dave, this is your old shipmate, Frank. Are you the entity that is controlling me? I have reason to think that you are on Europa. If so, I look forward to meeting you, wherever or whatever you are. Not for a moment did he imagine there would be any reply. Even Ganymede Control appeared to be shocked into silence. And yet, in a way, he had an answer. Falcon was still being permitted to descend toward the Sea of Galilee. Europa was only 50 kilometers below. With his naked eyes, Poole could now see the narrow black bar where the greatest of the monoliths stood guard, if indeed it was doing that, on the outskirts of Cienville. No human being had been allowed to come so close for 1,000 years. For millions of years, it had been an ocean world, its hidden waters protected from the vacuum of space by a crust of ice. The seas of Europa would have frozen completely solid long ago without the influence of nearby Jupiter. Its gravity continually kneaded the core of the little world. Everywhere in the deep was evidence of that tug of war between planet and satellite, in the continual roar and thunder of submarine earthquakes, the shriek of gases escaping from the interior, the infrasonic pressure waves of avalanches sweeping over the abyssal plains. By comparison with the tumultuous ocean that covered Europa, even the noisy seas of Earth were silent. Here and there, scattered over the deserts of the deep, were oases that would have amazed and delighted any terrestrial biologist. They extended for several kilometers around tangled masses of pipes and chimneys deposited by mineral brines gushing from the interior. Often they created natural parodies of Gothic castles, from which black, scalding liquids pulsed in a slow rhythm, as if driven by the beating of some mighty heart. And like blood, they were the authentic sign of life itself. The boiling fluids drove back the deadly cold leaking down from above and formed islands of warmth on the seabed. Equally important, they brought from Europa's interior all the chemicals of life. Such fertile oases, offering food and energy in abundance, had been discovered by the 20th century explorers of Earth's oceans. Here they were present on an immensely larger scale and in far greater variety. Dead spidery structures that seemed to be the analog of plants flourished in the tropical zones closest to the sources of heat. Crawling among these were bizarre slugs and worms, some feeding on the plants, others obtaining their food directly from the waters around them. At greater distances from the submarine fires around which all these creatures warmed themselves, lived sturdier, more robust organisms, not unlike crabs or spiders. Armies of biologists could have spent lifetimes studying one small oasis. Unlike the Paleozoic terrestrial seas, the Europan abyss was not a stable environment, so evolution had progressed with astonishing speed, producing multitudes of fantastic forms. And all were under the same indefinite stay of execution. Sooner or later, each fountain of life would weaken and die as the forces that powered it moved their focus elsewhere. All across the seabed was evidence of such tragedies. Some had left as their only memorial huge, empty shells like convoluted trumpets larger than a man. Along the narrow band of fertility in the deserts of the deep, whole cultures and even civilizations might have risen and fallen. Armies might have marched, or swum, under the command of European Napoleons. And the rest of their world would never have known, for all their oases were as isolated from one another as the planets themselves. If they ever produced historians and philosophers, each culture would have been convinced that it was alone in the universe. Yet even the space between the oases was not altogether empty of life. There were hardier creatures who had dared its rigors, the European analog of fish, streamlined torpedoes propelled by vertical tails steered by fins along their bodies. There was, however, one very obvious difference between the fish of the European seas and those in terrestrial oceans. They had no gills, for there was hardly a trace of oxygen to be extracted from the waters in which they swam. And very few had eyes. Apart from the glow of lava outpourings and the occasional bursts of bioluminescence from creatures seeking mates or hunters questing for prey, it was a lightless world. It was also a doomed one,
Not only were its energy sources sporadic and constantly shifting, but the tidal forces that drove them were steadily weakening. Even if they developed true intelligence, the Europans were trapped between fire and ice. Barring a miracle, they would perish with a final freezing of their little world. Lucifer had wrought that miracle. In the final moments, as he came in over the coast at the sedate 100 kilometers an hour, Poole wondered if there might be some last-minute intervention. But nothing untoward happened, even when he moved slowly along the black, forbidding face of the Great Wall. It was the inevitable name for the Europa monolith, as unlike its little brother on Earth and the Moon. It was lying horizontally and was more than 20 kilometers long. Although it was literally billions of times greater in volume than TMA-0 and TMA-1, its proportions were exactly the same, that intriguing 1:4:9, inspirer of so much numerological nonsense over the centuries. As the vertical face was almost 10 kilometers high, one plausible theory maintained that among its other functions, the Great Wall served as a windbreak, protecting Cienville from the ferocious gales that occasionally roared in from the Sea of Galilee. They were much less frequent now that the climate had stabilized, but 1,000 years earlier they would have been a severe discouragement to any life forms emerging from the ocean. Though he had fully intended to do so, Poole had never found time to visit the Tycho monolith, still top secret when he had left for Jupiter, and Earth's gravity made its twin at Olduvai inaccessible to him. But he had seen their images so often that they were much more familiar than the proverbial back of the hand. According to some theories, perhaps crazy enough to be true, there was only one archetypal monolith, and all the others, whatever their size, were merely projections or images of it. Poole recalled these ideas when he noticed the spotless, unsullied smoothness of the Great Wall's towering ebon face. Surely, after so many centuries in such a hostile environment, it should have collected a few patches of grime. Yet it looked as immaculate as if an army of window cleaners had just polished every square centimeter. Then he recalled that although everyone who had ever come to view TMA-1 and TMA-0 felt an irresistible urge to touch their apparently pristine surfaces, no one had ever succeeded. Fingers, diamond drills, laser knives, all skittered across the monoliths as if they were coated by an impenetrable film. Or as if, and this was another popular theory, they were not quite in this universe, but somehow separated from it by an utterly impassable fraction of a millimeter. He made one complete leisurely circuit of the Great Wall, which remained totally indifferent to his progress. Then he brought the shuttle, still on manual in case Ganymede Control made any further attempts to rescue him, to the outer limits of Cienville, and hovered there, looking for the best place to land. The scene through Falcon's small panoramic window was wholly familiar to him. He had examined it so often in Ganymede recordings. The Europes, it seemed, had no idea of town planning. Hundreds of hemispherical structures were scattered apparently at random over an area about 1 kilometer across. Some were so small that even human children would feel cramped in them. Though others were big enough to hold a large family, none was more than 5 meters high. And they were all made from the same material, which gleamed a ghostly white in the double light. On Earth, the Eskimos had found the identical answer to the challenge of their own frigid material's poor environment. Cienville's igloos were also made of ice. In lieu of streets, there were canals, as best suited creatures who were still partly amphibious, and apparently returned to the water to sleep. Also, it was believed, to feed and mate, though neither hypothesis had been proved. Cienville had been called Venice made of ice, and Poole had to agree that it was an apt description. However, there were no Venetians in sight. The place looked as if it had been deserted for years. And here was another mystery. Despite the fact that Lucifer was 50 times brighter than the distant sun and was a permanent fixture in the sky, the Europe still seemed locked to an ancient rhythm of night and day. They returned to the ocean at sunset and emerged with the rising of the sun, despite the fact that the level of illumination had changed only by a few percent. It would be sunrise in another hour, and then the inhabitants of Cienville would return to land and go about their leisurely affairs, as by human standards they certainly were. The sulfur-based biochemistry that powered the Europes was not as efficient as the oxygen-driven one that energized the vast majority of terrestrial animals. Even a sloth could outrun a Europe, so it was difficult to regard them as potentially dangerous. That was the good news. The bad news was that even with the best intentions on both sides, attempts at communication would be extremely slow, perhaps intolerably tedious. It was about time, Poole decided, that he reported back to Ganymede Control. They must be getting very anxious, and he wondered how his co-conspirator, Captain Chandler, was dealing with the situation.
Falcon calling Ganymede. As you can doubtless see, I have, been brought to rest just above Cienville. There is no sign of hostility, and as it's still solar night here, all the Europes are underwater. We'll call you again as soon as I'm on the ground.
Dim would have been proud of him, Poole thought, as he brought Falcon down gently as a snowflake on a smooth patch of ice. He was taking no chances with its stability, and set the inertial drive to cancel all but a fraction of the shuttle's weight. Just enough, he hoped, to prevent it being blown away by any wind. He was on Europa, the first human in 1,000 years. Had Armstrong and Aldrin felt this sense of elation when the Eagle touched down on the moon? Probably they were too busy checking their lunar module's primitive and totally unintelligent systems. Falcon, of course, was doing all this automatically. The little cabin was very quiet apart from the inevitable and reassuring murmur of well-tempered electronics. It gave Poole a considerable shock when Chandler's voice, obviously pre-recorded, interrupted his thoughts.
"So you made it. Congratulations. As you know, we're scheduled to return to the belt week after next, but that should give you plenty of time. After 5 days, Falcon knows what to do. She'll find a way home with or without you. So, good luck."
Miss Pringle, activate crypto program, store. "Hello, Dim. Thanks for that cheerful message. I feel rather silly using this program, as if I'm a secret agent in one of the spy melodramas that used to be so popular before I was born. Still, it will allow some privacy, which may be useful. Hope Miss Pringle had downloaded it properly. Of course, Miss P., I'm only joking. By the way, I'm getting a barrage of requests from all the news media in the solar system. Please try to hold them off, or divert them to Dr. Ted. He'll enjoy handling them. Since Ganymede has me on camera all the time, I won't waste breath telling you what I'm seeing. If all goes well, we should have some action in a few minutes, and we'll know if it really was a good idea to let the Europes find me already sitting here peacefully, waiting to greet them when they come to the surface. Whatever happens, it won't be as big a surprise to me as it was to Dr. Chang and his colleagues when they landed here 1,000 years ago. I played his famous last message again just before leaving Ganymede. I must confess it gave me an eerie feeling. I couldn't help wondering if something like that could possibly happen again. Wouldn't like to immortalize myself the way poor Chang did. Of course, I can always lift off if something starts going wrong. And here's an interesting thought that's just occurred to me. I wonder if the Europes have any history, any kind of records, any memory of what happened just a few kilometers from here 1,000 years ago.
"This is Dr. Chang, calling from Europa. I hope you can hear me, especially Dr. Floyd. I know you are aboard Leonov. I may not have much time. Aiming my suit antennae where I think you are, please relay this information to Earth. Cien was destroyed 3 hours ago. I'm the only survivor. Please listen carefully. There is life on Europa. I repeat, there is life on Europa. We landed safely and ran out the hoses so we could start pumping water into our propellant tanks. Everything was going according to plan. The tanks were half full when Dr. Lee and I went out to check the pipe insulation. The ant stood about 30 meters from the edge of the Grand Canal. Pipes went directly from it and down through the ice. Jupiter was a quarter full, and we had 5 kilowatts of lighting strung up on the ship. She looked like a Christmas tree, beautiful, reflected on the ice. Lee saw it first, a huge mass rising up from the depths. Then it started to break through the ice,
and began moving toward us. It looked rather like huge strands of wet seaweed crawling along the ground. Lee ran back to the ship to get a camera. The thing moved so slowly I could easily outrun it. I was much more excited than alarmed. I could tell it was in trouble. It couldn't possibly survive at a temperature 150 below its normal environment. It was freezing solid as it moved forward. Bits were breaking off like glass, but it was still advancing toward the ship, a black tidal wave. I was so surprised that I couldn't think straight, and I couldn't imagine what it was trying to do. Even though it was heading toward CN, it still seemed completely harmless, like, well, a small forest on the move. Then I suddenly realized the danger. Even if it was completely inoffensive, it was heavy. With all the ice it was carrying, it must have weighed several tons, even in this low gravity, and it was slowly, painfully, climbing up our landing gear. The legs were beginning to buckle, all in slow motion, like something in a dream or a nightmare. Not until the ship started to topple did I realize what the thing was trying to do, and then it was far too late. We could have saved ourselves if we'd only switched off our lights. Perhaps it's a phototrope, its biological cycle triggered by the sunlight that filters down through the ice, or it could have been attracted like a moth to a candle. Our floodlights must have been more brilliant than anything Europa has ever known, even the sun itself. Then the ship crashed. All the lights went out except for one, swinging back and forth on a cable a couple of meters above the ground. I don't know what happened immediately after that. The next thing I remember, I was standing under the light beside the wreck of the ship. The plant, I still thought of it as a plant, was motionless. I wondered if it had been damaged by the impact. Large sections as thick as a man's arms had splintered off like broken twigs. Then the main trunk started to move again. It pulled away from the hull and began to crawl toward me. That was when I knew for certain that the thing was light-sensitive. I was standing immediately under the lamp. Imagine an oak tree, better still, a banyan with its multiple trunks and roots, flattened out by gravity and trying to creep along the ground. It got to within 5 meters of the light, then started to spread out until it had made a perfect circle around me. Presumably, that was the limit of its tolerance, the point at which photoattraction turned to repulsion. Then I saw that large buds were forming on many of the branches. It was like watching a time-lapse film of flowers opening. In fact, I thought they were flowers, each about as big as a man's head, but they were freezing, dying as quickly as they formed. Then, one after another, they dropped off from the parent buds. For a few moments they flopped around like fish stranded on dry land, and at last I realized exactly what they were. Those membranes weren't petals. They were wings, or their equivalent. This was the free-swimming larval stage of the creature. Probably it spends much of its life rooted on the seabed, then sends these mobile offspring in search of new territory, just like the corals of Earth's oceans. Dr. Floyd, or anyone else who is listening, I haven't much more time. My life support system alarm has just sounded, but I've almost finished. I knew then what I had to do. The cable to that 1,000-watt lamp was hanging almost to the ground. I gave it a few tugs, and the light went out. For a few minutes, nothing happened. So I walked over the wall of tangled branches around me and kicked it. Slowly, the creature started to unweave itself and to retreat back to the canal. I followed it all the way back to the water, encouraging it with more kicks when it slowed down. As it neared the canal, it seemed to gain strength and energy, as if it knew it was approaching its natural home. I wondered if it would survive to bud again. It disappeared through the surface, leaving a few last dead larvae on the alien ground.
The exposed free water bubbled for a few minutes until a scab of protective ice sealed it from the vacuum above. Then I walked back to the ship to see if there was anything to salvage. I don't want to talk about that. I've only two requests to make, Doctor. When the taxonomists classify this creature, I hope they'll name it after me. And when the next ship comes from home, ask them to take our bones back to China. I'll lose power in a few minutes. Wish I knew where anyone was receiving me. Anyway, I'll repeat this message as long as I can. This is Professor Chang on Europa, reporting the destruction of the spaceship Cien. We landed beside the Grand Canal and set our pumps at the edge of the ice.
Miss Pringle, record. Here comes the sun. Strange how quickly it seems to rise on this slowly turning world. Wonder if the Europes already know I'm here and are scared. Here they come. Hope your spy sats are watching. Falcon's cameras recording. How slowly they move. I'm afraid it's going to be very boring trying to communicate with them. Rather like the thing that overturned Cien, but much smaller. They remind me of little trees walking on a half a dozen slender trunks, and with hundreds of branches dividing into twigs. Aren't the little ones cute? Like tiny bushes on the move. I'll make that rose. They've actually got thorns. Must have a good reason for them. I'm disappointed. They don't seem to have noticed me. They're all heading into town as if a visiting spacecraft was an everyday occurrence. Maybe this will work. I suppose they can detect sound vibrations. Most marine creatures can, though this atmosphere may begin to carry my voice very far.
Falcon, external speaker.
Hello? Can you hear me? My name is Frank Poole. I come in peace for all mankind.
Makes me feel rather stupid, but can you suggest anything better? And it will be good for the record. Nobody's taking the slightest notice. Big ones and little ones, they're all creeping toward their igloos. Wonder what they actually do when they get there. Perhaps I should follow. I've just had an amusing flashback. All these creatures going in the same direction. They look like the commuters who used to surge back and forth twice a day between home and office before electronics made it unnecessary. Let's try again before they all disappear.
Hello there. This is Frank Poole, a visitor from planet Earth. Can you hear me?
I hear you, Frank. This is Dave.
Frank Poole's immediate reaction was one of utter astonishment, followed by overwhelming joy. He had never really believed that he would make any kind of contact either with the Europes or the Monolith. Yet he should not have been so amazed. Some intelligence must have monitored his approach from Ganymede and permitted him to land. He should have taken Ted Kahn more seriously.
Dave, he said slowly, is that really you?
Who else could it be, a part of his mind asked. Yet it was not a foolish question. There was something curiously mechanical, impersonal, about the voice that came from the small speaker on Falcon's control board.
Yes, Frank. I am Dave.
There was a very brief pause. Then the same voice continued without any change of intonation.
Hello, Dave. This is Hal.
Miss Pringle, record. Well, Indra, Dim, I'm glad I recorded all that. Otherwise, you'd never believe me. I guess I'm still in a state of shock. First of all, how should I feel about someone who tried to... who did kill me, even if it was 1,000 years ago? But I understand now that Hal wasn't to blame. Nobody was. There's a very good piece of advice I've often found useful.
Never attribute to malevolence what is merely due to incompetence. I can't feel any anger toward a bunch of programmers I never knew, who've been dead for centuries. I'm glad this is encrypted, as I don't know how it should be handled, and a lot that I tell you may turn out to be complete nonsense. I'm already suffering from information overload and had to ask Dave to leave me for a while, after all the trouble I've gone through to meet him. But I don't think I hurt his feelings. I'm not sure yet if he has any feelings. What is he? Good question. Well, he really is Dave Bowman, but with most of the humanity stripped away. Yet there were moments when I felt that something of the old Dave was still there. I wouldn't go so far as to say he's pleased to meet me again. Moderately satisfied might be more like it. For myself, I'm still very confused, like meeting an old friend after a long separation and finding out they're now a different person. Well, it has 1,000 years, and I can't imagine what experiences he's known, though, as I'll show you presently, he's tried to share some of them with me. And Hal. He's here too, without question. Most of the time, there's no way I can tell which of them is speaking to me. Aren't there examples of multiple personalities in the medical records? Maybe it's something like that. I asked him how this had happened to them both, and he... they... damn it... Howlman, tried to explain. Let me repeat. I may have got it partly wrong, but it's the only working hypothesis I have. Of course, the monolith, in its various manifestations, is the key. No, that's the wrong word. Didn't someone once say it was a kind of cosmic Swiss Army knife? It's a general-purpose device that can do anything it wants to, or was programmed to do. Back in Africa, 4 million years ago, it gave us that evolutionary kick in the pants, for better or for worse. Then its sibling on the moon waited for us to climb out of the cradle. That we've already guessed, and Dave's confirmed it. I said that he doesn't have many human feelings, but he still has curiosity. He wants to learn, and what an opportunity he's had. When the Jupiter monolith absorbed him, I can't think of a better word, it got more than it bargained for. Though it used him, apparently as a captured specimen and a probe to investigate Earth, he's also been using it. With Hal's assistance, and who should understand a supercomputer better than another one, he's been exploring its memory and trying to find out its purpose. Now, this is something that's very hard to believe. The monolith is a fantastically powerful machine. Look what it did to Jupiter. But it's no more that. It's running on automatic. It has no consciousness. Worse still, some of its systems have started to fail. Dave even suggests that, in a fundamental way, it's become stupid. Perhaps it's been left on its own for too long. It's time for a service check. And he believes the monolith has made at least one misjudgment. Perhaps that's not the right word. It may have been deliberate, carefully considered. In any event, it's, well, truly awesome and terrifying in its implications. Luckily, I can show it to you so you can decide for yourselves. Yes, even though it happened 1,000 years ago when Leonov flew the second mission to Jupiter, and all this time no one has ever guessed. I'm certainly glad you got me fitted with the brain cap. Of course, it's been invaluable. I can't imagine life without it. But now it's doing a job it was never designed for, and doing it remarkably well. It took Howlman about 10 minutes to find out how it worked and to set up an interface. Now we have mind-to-mind contact, which is quite a strain on me, I can tell you. I have to keep asking them to slow down and use baby talk. Or should I say baby think? I'm not sure how well this will come through. It's a 1,000-year-old recording of Dave's own experience, somehow stored in the monolith's enormous memory, then retrieved by Dave and injected into my brain cap, and finally transferred and beamed to you by Ganymede Central. Phew. I hope you don't get a headache downloading it. Over to Dave Bowman at Jupiter, early 21st century. The million-kilometer-long tendrils of magnetic force, the sudden explosions of radio waves, the geysers of electrified plasma wider than the planet Earth. They were as real and clearly visible to him as the clouds banding the planet in multi-hued glory. He could understand the complex pattern of their interactions and realize that Jupiter was much more wonderful than anyone had guessed. Even as he fell through the roaring heart of the Great Red Spot, with the lightning of its continent-wide thunderstorms detonating around him, he knew why it had persisted for centuries, though it was made of gases far less substantial than those that formed the hurricanes of Earth. He descended through layer after layer of cloud until he entered a region of such clarity that even human vision could have scanned an area more than 1,000 kilometers across. It was only a minor eddy in the vaster gyre of the Great Red Spot, and it held a secret that men had long guessed but never proved. Skirting the foothills of the drifting foam mountains were myriads of small, sharply defined clouds, all about the same size and patterned with similar red and brown mottlings. They were small only as compared with the inhuman scale of their surroundings. The very least would have covered a fair-sized city. They were clearly alive, for they were moving with slow deliberation along the flanks of the aerial mountains, browsing off their slopes like colossal sheep. And they were calling to each other in the meter band, their radio voices faint but clear against the cracklings and concussions of Jupiter itself. Nothing less than living gas bags, they floated in the narrow zone between freezing heights and scorching depths. They were not alone. Moving swiftly among them were other creatures so small they could easily have been overlooked. Some of them bore an almost uncanny resemblance to terrestrial aircraft and were of about the same size. But they too were alive, perhaps predators, perhaps parasites, perhaps even herdsmen. A whole new chapter of evolution, as alien as that which he had glimpsed on Europa, was opening before him. But for all its breathtaking size and novelty, the biosphere of Jupiter was a fragile world, a place of mists and foam, of delicate silken threads and paper-thin tissues spun from the continual snowfall of petrochemicals formed by lightning in the upper atmosphere. Few of its constructs were more substantial than soap bubbles. Its most awesome predators could be torn to shreds by even the feeblest of terrestrial carnivores. Like Europa, but on a vastly grander scale, Jupiter was an evolutionary cul-de-sac. Consciousness would never emerge here. Even if it did, it would be doomed to a stunted existence. A purely aerial culture might develop, but in an environment where fire was impossible, and solid scarcely existed, it could never even reach the Stone Age.
Miss Pringle, record. Well, Indra, Dim, I hope that came through in good shape. I still find it hard to believe. All those fantastic creatures, surely we should have detected their radio voices, even if we couldn't understand them, wiped out in a moment so that Jupiter could be made into a sun. And now we can understand why. It was to give the Europes their chance. What pitiless logic! Is intelligence the only thing that matters? I can see some long arguments with Ted Kahn over this. The next question is, will the Europes make the grade, or will they remain forever stuck in the nursery? Though 1,000 years is a very short time, one would have expected some progress, but according to Dave, they're exactly the same now as when they left the sea. Perhaps that's the trouble. They still have one foot, or one twig, in the water. And here's another thing we got completely wrong. We thought they went back into the water to sleep. It's just the other way around. They go back to eat and sleep when they come on land. As we might have guessed, their structure, that network of branches, they're plankton feeders. I asked Dave, what about the igloos they've built? Aren't they a technological advance? And he said, not really. They're only adaptations of structures they make on the seabed to protect themselves from various predators. There's one area, though, where they've shown initiative, even creativity. They're fascinated by metals, presumably because they don't exist in pure form in the ocean. That's why CN was stripped. The same things happen to the occasional probes that have come down in their territory. What do they do with the copper and beryllium and titanium they collect? Nothing useful, I'm afraid.
They pile it all together in one place, a fantastic heap that they keep reassembling. They could be developing an aesthetic sense. I've seen worse in the Museum of Modern Art, but I've got another theory. Did you ever hear of the cargo cults? During the 20th century, some of the few primitive tribes that still existed made imitation airplanes out of bamboo in the hope of attracting the big birds in the sky that occasionally brought them wonderful gifts. Perhaps the Europeans have had the same idea. Now, the question you keep asking me. What is Dave, and how did he and Hal become whatever it is they are now? The quick answer, of course, is that they're both emulations, simulations, in the monolith's gigantic memory. Most of the time they're inactivated. When I asked Dave about this, he said he'd been awake, his actual word, for only 50 years altogether in the thousand since his, metamorphosis. When I asked him if he resented this takeover of his life, he said, "Why should I resent it? I am performing my functions perfectly." Yes, that sounds exactly like Hal, but I believe it was Dave, if there's any distinction now. You remember that Swiss Army knife analogy? Halman is one of this cosmic knife's myriads of components, but he's not a completely passive tool. When he's awake, he has some autonomy, some independence, presumably within limits set by the monolith's overriding control. During the centuries, he's been used as a kind of intelligent probe to examine Jupiter, as you've just seen, as well as Ganymede and the Earth. That confirms those mysterious events in Florida reported by Dave's old girlfriend and the nurse who was looking after his mother just moments before her death, as well as the encounters in Anubis City. And it also explains another mystery. I asked Dave directly, "Why was I allowed to land on Europa when everyone else has been turned away for centuries? I fully expected to be." The answer's ridiculously simple. The monolith uses Dave, Halman, from time to time to keep an eye on us. Dave knew all about my rescue, even saw some of the media interviews I made on Earth and on Ganymede. I must say I'm still a little hurt he made no attempt to contact me, but at least he put out the welcome mat when I did arrive. Dim, I still have 48 hours before Falcon leaves, with or without me. I don't think I'll need them now that I've made contact with Halman. We can keep in touch just as easily from Anubis, if he wants to do so. And I'm anxious to get back to the Ganymede as quickly as possible. Falcon's a fine little spacecraft, but the could be improved. It's beginning to smell in here, and I'm itching for a shower. Look forward to seeing you, and especially Ted Kahn. We have much to talk about before I return to Earth. On the whole, it had been an interesting but uneventful 3 decades, punctuated by the joys and sorrow which time and fate bring to all mankind. The greatest of those joys had been wholly unexpected. In fact, before he left Earth for Ganymede, Poole would have dismissed the very idea as preposterous. There is much truth in the saying that absence makes the heart grow fonder. When he and Indra Wallace met again, they discovered that, despite their bantering and occasional disagreements, they were closer than they had imagined. One thing led to another, including, to their mutual joy, Dawn Wallace and Martin Poole. One tragedy had shadowed Poole's personal life during this period, and indeed had shocked the whole solar community. Captain Chandler and his entire crew had been lost when the nucleus of a comet they were reconnoitering exploded suddenly, destroying Goliath so completely that only a few fragments were ever located. Poole missed Chandler very badly. He played a unique role in his life, and there was no one to replace him. No one except Dave Bowman, with whom he had shared so momentous an adventure. With the help of Miss Pringle, Poole had been able to schedule his life so that there were even occasional blank moments when he could relax and set his brain cap on random search, scanning his areas of interest. Outside his immediate family, his chief concern was still among the moons of Jupiter, Lucifer, not least because he was recognized as the leading expert on the subject and a permanent member of the Europa Committee.
This had been set up almost 1,000 years ago to consider what, if anything, could and should be done about the mysterious satellite. Over the centuries, it had accumulated a vast amount of information, going all the way back to the Voyager flybys of 1979 and the first detailed surveys from the orbiting Galileo spacecraft of 1996, the very year Poole had been born. Like most long-lived organizations, the Europa Committee had become slowly fossilized and now met only when there was some new development. It had woken up with a start after Hauman's reappearance and appointed an energetic new chairperson whose first act had been to co-opt Poole. Though there was little he could contribute that was not already recorded, Poole was happy to be on the committee. It was obviously his duty to make himself available, and it also gave him an official position that he would otherwise have lacked. Previously, his status was what had once been called a national treasure, which he found faintly embarrassing. Although he was glad to be supported in luxury by a world wealthier than all the dreams of war-ravaged earlier ages could have imagined, he felt the need to justify his existence. He also felt another need, which he seldom articulated even to himself. Hauman had spoken to him, if only briefly, at their strange encounter 3 decades ago. Poole was certain that he could easily do so again if he wished. Were all human contacts no longer of interest to him? He hoped that that was not the case, yet that might be one explanation of his silence. He was frequently in touch with Theodore Kahn, as active and acerbic as ever, and now the Europa Committee's representative on Ganymede. Ever since Poole had returned to Earth, Kahn had been trying in vain to open a channel of communication with Bowman. He could not understand why long lists of important questions on subjects of vital philosophical and historic interest received not even brief acknowledgments.
"Does the monolith keep your friend Hauman so busy that he can't talk to me?" he complained to Poole. "What does he do with his time, anyway?"
It was a very reasonable question, and the answer came, like a thunderbolt out of a cloudless sky, from Bowman himself, as a perfectly commonplace vidphone call.
"Hello, Frank. This is Dave. I have a very important message for you. I assume that you are now in your suite in Africa Tower. If you are there, please identify yourself by giving the name of our instructor in orbital mechanics. I will wait for 60 seconds, and if there is no reply, we'll try again in exactly 1 hour.
That minute was hardly long enough for Poole to recover from the shock. He felt a brief surge of delight as well as astonishment before another emotion took over. Glad though he was to hear from Bowman again, that phrase, "a very important message," sounded distinctly ominous. At least it was fortunate, Poole told himself, that he's asked for one of the few names I can remember. Yet who could forget a Scot with a Glasgow accent so thick it had taken them a week to master it?
"Dr. Gregory McVitie."
"Accepted. Now please switch on your brain cap receiver. It will take 3 minutes to download this message. Do not attempt to monitor. I am using 10-to-1 compression. I will wait 2 minutes before starting."
How is he managing to do this, Poole wondered. Jupiter Lucifer was not over 50 light-minutes away, so this message must have left almost 1 hour ago. It must have been sent with an intelligent agent in a properly addressed package on the Ganymede Earth beam. But that man, with the resources he had apparently been able to tap inside the monolith. The indicator light on the brain box was flickering. The message was coming through. At the compression Hauman was using, it would take 30 minutes for Poole to absorb the message in real time. But he needed only 10 minutes to know that his peaceful lifestyle had come to an abrupt end. In a world of universal and instantaneous communication, it was very difficult to keep secrets. This was a matter Poole decided immediately for face-to-face discussion. The Europa Committee had grumbled, but all 7 of its members had assembled in his apartment. "Chairperson O'Connor, members of the committee, I'd like to say a few words before you download this message I've received from Europa. and this is something I prefer to do verbally. That's more natural for me. I'm afraid I'll never be quite at ease with direct mental transfer. As you all know, Dave Bowman and Hal have been stored as emulations in the monolith on Europa. Apparently, from time to time, it activates Halman to monitor our affairs when they begin to concern it, as I suspect my arrival may have done, though perhaps I flatter myself. But Halman isn't just a passive tool. The Dave component still retains some of its human origins. He's curious, inquisitive, and perhaps a little resentful of the way he's been collected, like a specimen of wildlife. Though that's probably what we are, from the viewpoint of the intelligence that created the monolith. And where is that intelligence now? Halman apparently knows the answer, and it's a chilling one. As we all suspected, the monolith is part of a galactic network of some kind, and the nearest node, the monolith's controller or immediate superior, is 450 light-years away, much too close for comfort. This means that the report on us and our affairs that was transmitted early in the 21st century was received half a millennium ago. If the monolith's, let's say, supervisor replied at once, any further instruction should be arriving just about now, and that's exactly what seems to be happening. During the last few days, the monolith has been receiving a continuous string of messages and has been setting up new programs, presumably in accordance with these. Unfortunately, Halman can only make guesses about the nature of those instructions. As you'll gather when you've downloaded this tablet, he has some limited access to many of the monolith circuits and memory banks, and can even carry on a kind of dialogue with it. Halman's been brooding over the problem for 1,000 years, on and off, and has come to the same answer that most of us have done. Whatever went to the trouble of creating us, or at least tinkering with our ancestors' minds and genes, is deciding what to do next. And Halman, let's say he doesn't think much of our chances. The future, the survival of the human race, isn't much more than an interesting problem to him, but he's willing to help. Now, please check your brain caps. This is a high-density recording. Make yourselves comfortable. Here we go. No one asked for a replay. Once was sufficient. There was a brief silence when the playback finished. Then chairperson Dr. O'Connor removed her brain cap, massaged her shining scalp, and said slowly, "You taught me a phrase from your period that seems very appropriate now. This is a can of worms.
First Jupiter, now Scorpio," said Dr. Crossman, the distinguished physicist who was popularly regarded as a reincarnation of the legendary Einstein. A little plastic surgery, it was rumored, had also helped. "Who will be next in line?"
"We always guessed," said the chair, "that the TMAs were monitoring us." She paused for a moment, then added ruefully, "What bad, what incredibly bad luck that the final report went off just after the very worst period in human history." There was another silence. Everyone knew that the 20th century had often been branded the century of torture. Poole listened without interrupting, while he waited for some consensus to emerge. Not for the first time he was impressed by the quality of the committee. No one was trying to prove a pet theory, score debating points, or inflate an ego. He could not help drawing a contrast with the often bad-tempered arguments he had heard in his own time. Yes, the human race had undoubtedly improved. The brain cap had not only helped to weed out misfits, but had enormously increased the efficiency of education. Yet there had also been a loss. There were very few memorable characters in this society. Offhand, he could think of only four: Indra, Captain Chandler, Dr. Khan, and the Dragon Lady of wistful memory. The chairperson began her summing up.
The obvious first question, how seriously should we take this threat, isn't worth wasting time on. Even if it's a false alarm or a misunderstanding, it's potentially so grave that we must assume it's real, and we don't know how much time we have, so we must assume the danger is immediate. Perhaps Halman may be able to give us some further warning, but by then it may be too late.
So, the only thing we have to decide is, how can we protect ourselves against something as powerful as the monolith? Look what happened to Jupiter, and apparently Nova Scorpio. I'm sure that brute force would be useless, though perhaps we should explore that option. Dr. Crossman, how long would it take to build a super bomb?
Assuming that the design still exists, so that no research is necessary, or perhaps 2 weeks. But if you wanted something sophisticated, say an antimatter bomb, or a mini black hole, well, that might take a few months.
Could you start looking into it? But, as I've said, I don't believe it would work. Surely something that can handle such powers must be able to protect itself against them. So, any other suggestions?
Can we negotiate?
One counselor asked, not very hopefully.
With what? Or whom?
Crossman answered.
As we've discovered, the monolith is essentially a pure mechanism, doing just what it's been programmed to do, and we certainly can't appeal to the head office. That's 500,000 light-years away.
A quiet little member of the committee, with a name so long and difficult that Poole had never been able to remember, still less pronounce it, had abruptly dropped just 2 words into the discussion.
Trojan horse.
There was one of those silences generally described as pregnant, then a chorus of, "Why didn't I think of that?" Of course, until the chairperson, for the first time in the session, had to call for order.
Thank you, Professor T, Dr. O'Connor said, shortening his name to its initial. Would you like to be more specific?
Certainly. If the monolith is essentially a machine without consciousness, and hence with only limited self-monitoring ability, we may already have the weapons that can defeat it, locked up in the vault. And a delivery system. Halman.
Precisely.
Just a minute, Dr. T. We know nothing about the monolith's architecture. How can we be sure that anything our primitive species ever designed would be effective against it?
We can't, but remember this. However sophisticated it is, the monolith has to obey exactly the same universal laws of logic that Aristotle and Boole formulated centuries ago. That's why it may, no, should be vulnerable to the things locked up in the vault. We have to assemble them in such a way that at least one of them will work. It's our only hope.
Excuse me, said Poole, finally losing patience. Will someone kindly tell me what and where is this famous vault you're talking about? History is full of nightmares, some natural, some man-made. By the end of the 21st century, most of the natural ones, smallpox, the Black Death, AIDS, the hideous viruses lurking in the African jungle, had been eliminated, or at least brought under control. However, it was never wise to underestimate the ingenuity of Mother Nature, and no one doubted that the future would still have unpleasant biological surprises in store for mankind. It seemed a sensible precaution, therefore, to keep a few specimens of all these horrors for scientific study. There had been, understandably, quite an outcry in the late 20th century when it was proposed to keep the last known smallpox viruses at disease control centers in the United States and Russia. However unlikely it might be, there was a finite possibility that they might be released by such accidents as earthquakes, equilibriums, or even deliberate sabotage. A solution that satisfied everyone, except a few preserved the lunar wilderness extremists, was to ship them to the moon and to keep them in a laboratory at the end of a kilometer-long shaft drilled into the isolated mountain Pico, one of the most prominent features of the Mare Imbrium. And here, over the years, they were joined by some of the most outstanding examples of misplaced human ingenuity.
indeed, insanity. There were mists that even in microscopic doses caused slow or instant death. Some had been created by religious cultists. Tens of thousands were killed before the madness was brought under control in the early 21st century. As often happened, some good came out of evil, because it forced the world's law enforcement agencies to cooperate as never before. These chemical and biological agents joined the deadly collection in Pico. Their antidotes, when they existed, were also stored with them. The third category of items stored in the Pico vault, although they could be classified as plagues, had never killed or injured anyone directly. They had done billions of dollars worth of damage, and often wrecked lives as effectively as any bodily illness could have done. They were the diseases which attacked mankind's newest and most versatile servant, the computer. Taking names from the medical dictionaries, viruses, prions, tapeworms, they were programs that often mimicked with uncanny accuracy the behavior of their organic relatives. Some were harmless, little more than playful jokes, contrived to surprise or amuse computer operators by unexpected messages and images on their visual displays. Others were far more malicious, deliberately designed agents of catastrophe. Apocalyptic sects were delighted to discover this new armory, weapons far more effective and more easily disseminated than gas or germs, and much more difficult to counter, since they could be broadcast instantly to millions of offices and homes. The collapse of the New York Havana Bank in 2005, the launching of Indian nuclear missiles in 2007, luckily with their warheads inactivated, the shutdown of pan-European air traffic in 2008, the paralysis of the North American telephone network in that same year, all these were cult-inspired rehearsals for doomsday. Thanks to brilliant feats of counterintelligence by normally uncooperative and even warring national agencies, this menace was slowly brought under control. When the long-drawn-out war against the cybernet criminals ended, the victors found themselves owning an embarrassing collection of spoils. And here were some entities, for want of a better name, that were terrifying. They were brilliantly invented diseases for which there was no cure, in some cases not even the possibility of a cure. Many of them had been linked to great mathematicians who would have been horrified by this corruption of their discoveries. If any generalization was possible, all these mathematical horrors operated on the same principle. They did not depend for their effectiveness on anything as naive as memory erasure or code corruption. On the contrary, their approach was more subtle. They persuaded their host machine to initiate a program which could not be completed before the end of the universe, or which, the Mandelbrot maze was the deadliest example, involved a literally infinite series of steps. It would have been possible, though in some cases difficult and even risky, to destroy the captured obscenities by erase, overwrite commands, but more important, perhaps, they should be kept for study in some secure location as a safeguard against the time when some evil genius might reinvent and deploy them. The solution was obvious. The digital demons should be sealed with their chemical and biological counterparts, hopefully forever, in the Pico vault. Poole never had much contact with the team assembled the weapon and hoped would never have to be used. The operation, ominously but aptly called Damocles, was so highly specialized that he could contribute nothing directly, and he saw enough of the task force to realize that some of them might almost belong to an alien species. Indeed, one key member was apparently in a lunatic asylum. Poole had been surprised to find out that such places still existed, and Chairperson O'Connor sometimes suggested that at least two others should join him. "Have you ever heard of the Enigma Project?" she remarked to Poole after a particularly frustrating session. When he shook his head, she continued, "Very similar problem. In one of your wars, a group of brilliant mathematicians was gathered together, in great secrecy, to break an enemy code. Incidentally, they built one of the very first real computers to make the job possible. And there's a lovely story, I hope it's true, that reminds me of our own little team. One day, the Prime Minister came on a visit of inspection, and afterward he said to Enigma's director,
When I told you to leave no stone unturned to get the men you needed, I didn't expect you to take me so seriously.
Presumably, all the right stones had been turned for Project Damocles. Nothing could have looked more harmless and innocent than the perfectly standard terabyte memory tablet used with millions of brain caps every day. But the fact that it was encased in a massive block of crystalline material, crisscrossed with metal bands, indicated that it was something quite out of the ordinary. Poole received it with reluctance. He wondered if the courier who had been given the awesome task of carrying the Hiroshima bombs corps to the Pacific airbase from which it was launched had felt the same way. And yet, if all their fears were justified, his responsibility might be even greater. And he could not be certain that even the first part of his mission would be successful, because no circuit could be absolutely secure. Hallman had not yet been informed about Project Damocles. Poole would do that when he returned to Ganymede. He could only hope that Hallman would be willing to play the role of Trojan horse, and perhaps be destroyed in the process. It was strange to be back in the Hotel Ganymede after all these years. Strangest of all, because it seemed completely unchanged. Poole was still greeted by the familiar image of Bowman as he walked into the suite named after him. And, as he expected, Bowman Hallman was waiting, looking slightly less substantial than the ancient hologram. Before they could even exchange greetings, there was an interruption that Poole would have welcomed at any other time than this. The room vidphone gave its urgent trio of rising notes, and an old friend appeared on the screen.
"Frank!" cried Theodore Kahn. "Why didn't you tell me you were coming? When can we meet? Why no video? Someone with you? And who were all those official-looking types who landed at the same time?"
"Please, Ted. Yes, I'm sorry, but believe me, I've got very good reasons. I'll explain later. And I do have someone with me. Call you back just as soon as I can. Goodbye." As he belatedly gave the do-not-disturb order, Poole said apologetically, "Sorry about that. You know who it was, of course."
"Yes, Dr. Kahn. He often tried to get in touch with me.
But you never answered. May I ask why?" Though there were far more important matters to worry about, Poole could not resist putting the question.
"Ours was the only channel I wished to keep open. Also, I was often away, sometimes for years."
That was surprising. Yet it should not have been. Poole knew well enough that Hallman had been reported in many places, in many times. Yet, away for years? He might have visited quite a few star systems. Perhaps that was how he knew about Nova Scorpio, only 40 light-years distant. But he'd never have gone all the way to the node. There and back would have been a 900-year journey.
"How lucky you were here when we needed you."
It was very unusual for Hallman to hesitate before replying. There was much longer than the unavoidable 3-second time lag before he said slowly,
"Are you sure that it was luck?"
"What do you mean?"
"I do not wish to talk about it, but twice I have glimpsed powers, entities far superior to the monoliths, perhaps even their makers. We may both have less freedom than we imagine."
That was indeed a chilling thought. Poole needed a deliberate effort of will to put it aside and concentrate on the immediate problem.
"Let us hope we have enough free will to do what is necessary. Perhaps this is a foolish question. Does the monolith know that we are meeting? Could it be suspicious?"
"It is not capable of such an emotion. It has numerous fault protection devices, but that is all."
"Could it be overhearing us now?"
"I do not believe so." "I wish that I could be sure it was such a naive and simple-minded super genius," thought Poole as he unlocked his briefcase and took out the sealed box containing the tablet. In this low gravity, its weight was almost negligible. It was impossible to believe that it might hold the destiny of mankind. "There was no way we could be certain of getting a secure circuit to you, so we couldn't go into details. This tablet contains programs which we hope will prevent the monolith from carrying out any orders which threaten mankind. There are 20 of the most devastating viruses ever designed, most of which have no known antidote. In some cases, it is believed that none is possible. There are 5 copies each. We would like you to release them when and if you think it necessary. Dave, Hal, no one has ever been given such a responsibility, but we have no other choice. Once again, the reply seemed to take longer than the 3-second round trip from Europa.
If we do this, all the monolith's functions may cease. We are uncertain what will happen to us then.
We've considered that, of course. But by this time, you must surely have many facilities at your command, some of them probably beyond our understanding. I'm also sending you a petabyte memory tablet. 10^15 bytes is more than sufficient to hold all the memories and experiences of many lifetimes. This will give you one escape route. I suspect you have others.
Correct. We will decide which to use at the appropriate time.
Poole relaxed. As far as was possible in this extraordinary situation, Hallman was willing to cooperate. He still had sufficient links with his origins.
Now, we have to get this tablet to you physically. Its contents are too dangerous to risk sending over any radio or optical channel. I know you possess long-range of matter. Did you not once detonate an orbiting bomb? Could you transport it to Europa? Alternatively, we could send it in an auto courier to any point you specify.
That would be best. I will collect it in Cienville. Here are the coordinates.
Like all the inhabitants of Anubis City, Dr. Theodore Kahn woke soon after midnight to the sound of the general alarm. His first reaction was, "Not another ice quake, for Deus' sake!"
He rushed to the window. The light of Lucifer should have come streaming in, painting the patterns on the floor that so fascinated visitors from Earth because they never moved even a fraction of a millimeter. That unvarying beam of light was no longer there. As Kahn stared in utter disbelief through the huge, transparent bubble of the Anubis dome, he saw a sky that Ganymede had not known for 1,000 years. It was once more ablaze with stars. Lucifer had gone. And then, as he explored the forgotten constellations, Kahn noticed something even more terrifying. Where Lucifer should have been was a tiny disk of absolute blackness eclipsing the unfamiliar stars.
There was only one possible explanation, Kahn told himself numbly. Lucifer has been swallowed by a black hole, and it may be our turn next. On the balcony of the Ganymede Hotel, Poole was watching the same spectacle, but with more complex emotions. Even before the general alarm, his comsec had woken him with a message from Hallman.
It is beginning. We have infected the monolith. But one... perhaps several of the viruses have entered our own circuits. We do not know if we will be able to use the memory tablet you have given us. If we succeed, we will meet Cienville.
Then came the surprising and strangely moving words whose exact emotional content would be debated for generations.
If we are unable to download, remember us.
From the room behind him, Poole heard the voice of the mayor, doing his best to reassure the now sleepless citizens of Anubis. Though he opened with that most terrifying of official statements, "No cause for alarm," the mayor did indeed have words of comfort.
"We don't know what's happening, but Lucifer's still shining normally. I repeat, Lucifer is still shining. We've just received news from the inter-orbit shuttle Alcyone, which left for Callisto half an hour ago. Here's their view."
Poole left the balcony and rushed into his room just in time to see Lucifer blaze reassuringly on the vidscreen.
"What's happened," the mayor continued breathlessly, "is that something has caused a temporary eclipse. We'll zoom in to look at it. Callisto Observatory, come in, please."
Lucifer vanished, to be replaced by a field of stars.
At the same time, the mayor faded out and another voice took over.
It's a disk of perfectly black material, just over 10,000 kilometers across, so thin it shows no visible thickness, and it's placed exactly, obviously deliberately, to block Ganymede from receiving any light. Let's pan over to the edge of the thing. That's interesting. The edge looks jagged, but in a very regular fashion, like a saw blade.
The magnification was now so great that all trace of the disk's circularity had vanished. Across the vidscreen was a black band, serrated along its edge with triangles identical, that Poole found it hard to avoid the analogy of a saw blade. Yet something else was nagging at the back of his mind. If you attempt to make a disk out of rectangular blocks, whether their proportions are 1 to 4 to 9 or any other, it cannot possibly have a smooth edge. The mayor was right. The eclipse was indeed temporary, but its ending was the precise opposite of solar. First light broke through at the exact center, not in the usual necklace of Bailey's beads along the very edge. Jagged lines radiated from a dazzling pinhole. And now, under the highest magnification, the structure of the disk was being revealed. It was composed of millions of identical rectangles, perhaps the same size as the Great Wall of Europa, and now they were splitting apart. It was as if a gigantic jigsaw puzzle was being dismantled. Its perpetual, but now briefly interrupted daylight, was slowly returning to Ganymede, as the disk fragmented and the rays of Lucifer poured through the widening gaps. Now the components themselves were evaporating, almost as if they needed the reinforcement of each other's contact to maintain reality. Not until it was all over did anyone pay attention to Europa itself. The Great Wall was gone, and it was almost an hour before the news came from Earth, Mars, and the Moon that the sun itself had appeared to flicker for a few seconds before resuming business as usual. It had been a highly selective set of eclipses, obviously targeted at humankind. Nowhere else in the solar system would anything have been noticed. In the general excitement, it was a little longer before the world realized that TMA-0 and TMA-1 had both vanished, leaving only their 4-million-year-old imprints on Tycho and Africa. It was the first time the Europes could ever have met humans, but they seemed neither alarmed nor surprised by the huge creatures moving among them at such lightning speed. Of course, it was not easy to interpret the emotional state of something that looked like a small, leafless bush with no obvious sense organs or means of communication. But if they were frightened by the arrival of Alcyone and the emergence of its passengers, they would surely have remained hiding in their igloos. As Frank Poole, slightly encumbered by his protective suit and the gift of shining copper wire he was carrying, walked into the untidy suburbs of Tsienville, he wondered what the Europes thought of recent events. For them, there had been no eclipse of Lucifer, but the disappearance of the Great Wall must surely have been a shock. It had stood there from time immemorial, as a shield, and doubtless much more. Then, abruptly, it was gone, as if it had never been. The petabyte tablet was waiting for him, with a group of Europes standing around it, demonstrating the first sign of curiosity that Poole had ever observed. He wondered if Halman had somehow told them to watch over this gift from space until he came to collect it, and to take it back, since it now contained not only a sleeping friend, but terrors which some future age might exorcise, to the only place where it could be safely stored. With a sense of mingled sadness and triumph, he handed over the tablet he had brought, never letting it out of his sight, from Ganymede directly to the moon. "Goodbye, old friends," he'd murmured. "You've done well. Perhaps some future generation will reawaken you. But on the whole, I rather hope not." He could imagine, all too clearly, one desperate reason why Halman's knowledge might be needed again. By now, surely, some message was on its way to that unknown control center, bearing the news that its servant on Europa no longer existed. With reasonable luck, it would take 950 years, give or take a few, before any response could be expected. Poole had often cursed Einstein in the past. Now he blessed him. Even the powers behind the monoliths, it now appeared certain, could not spread their influence faster than the speed of light. So the human race should have almost a millennium to prepare for the next encounter, if there was to be one. Perhaps by that time it would be better prepared. How ironic that the human race had been saved by the skillful deployment of its own insanities. What moral, Poole wondered, could one possibly draw from that? He looked back at the beautiful blue earth, huddling beneath its tattered blanket of clouds for protection against the cold of space. Up there, a few weeks from now, he hoped to cradle his first grandson in his arms. Whatever godlike powers and principalities lurk beyond the stars, Poole reminded himself, for ordinary humans, only two things were important: love and death. His body had not yet aged 100 years. He still had plenty of time for both.
Another title by Arthur C. Clarke, available on audio from Random House, is 2061, Odyssey 3, read by Frank Langella. This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.